We'll call the meeting of the Commerce Committee to order, the hour of 12:30 p.m. having arrived. We have a very busy day today. When we have a quorum, I will we'll stop the meeting. We'll take care of a few housekeeping items here. Today we have the House File 1681, the Bradley Bill. We'll have an amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like to work on it. I'd like to announce right up front that if you're testifying for or against the bill, we are going to stick very closely to the articles that I'm about to read. This entire bill does not deal with the Commerce Committee. Much of it does. We're going to be, if you have testimony for or against on Article 1, Sections 1, 2, or 3, not 4, we're skipping Article 2 and Article 3. We'll be taking up Article 4, all items. Article 5, only item 3. Article 6, the entire article, and Article 7. So if someone here is to testify on other aspects, I do want you to know that the medical malpractice part is being heard in committee tomorrow. So we will not be discussing that part. That will be in civil law. So if you're interested in that part of the bill, I know there's quite a few people that are. We'll be looking at that. Now, I'm going to go through the agenda for today, and we really have to stick to the timelines because, as you know, the committee's been bogged down on an issue here recently, and we've got to get moving. Deadlines, we don't know when they are, but I've got a feeling they'll be very soon. So with that, the timeline for today will be Chairman Bradley will present his bill. He'll have till about 12:45. People that wish to support the Bradley bill will have from 12:45 to 1 o'clock. People against the bill will have the exact same amount of time from 1 to 1:15. We'll have members' questions from 1:15 to 1:30. We will have amendments from 1:30 to 1:45, and then I'm going to call it to a vote if I have the support of the committee to do that. Hint, hint. And then at 1:45, we're going to be taking, in your packets, members, there's an amendment. It's the A29 amendment. Pull that out. That will not be offered to the Bradley bill at 1:45. The reason I'm really going to watch the time here is because we have folks in here that wish to testify on an amendment that will be a bill. It's the David's Clark ovarian cancer screening mandate bill. We will be hearing from people for and against that, mainly for today, because we have some people, several medical doctors here that we want to get their testimony on the tape, and members remember what they're saying, because when we do have the bill before us, we're not going to have them all come in again unless they want to. They can sure come in if they want to, but there'll be limited debate at that time. We're going to have most of the testimony and so forth today. So pull the 829 amendment. That'll be from 1:45 to 2:15. Do we have a quorum? We don't have a quorum yet. So Representative Chairman Bradley, welcome to the Commerce Committee, and if you could please address the items that I talked about. I would like to not have questions while he's giving his testimony so we can get through that. There will be a time for members' questions. So with that, welcome to the committee, and I'll move your bill when we have a quorum, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. Before we do that, I'm pleased to announce today the ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School are here. Where are you? You're up there. Welcome to the committee. We're glad you're here. Dominic, we're glad you're here, too. Okay, with that, Chairman Bradley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I hope you're enjoying the goodies. I try to follow the protocols. I did serve on this committee, and I'm just trying to keep up with the right protocols for the committee, so that was my attempt. Let me move very quickly into this, because I want to respect the Chair's wishes. I don't think I have to remind, but let me just sort of reemphasize that all of us know that our constituents at every level, employers, health plans, employees, union members, you name it, everybody on the street knows that healthcare costs are exploding. It's time, in my opinion, that we try to do some very specific things about it. We begin a campaign, and the bill that's before you is an attempt to have a comprehensive of what we can at least do in the near term and get the ball rolling even strategically on very, very specific initiatives on a very, very broad base. The sheet that you have in front of you that looks sort of like this is my attempt to try to bring our attention to those areas that I think the chairman's already mentioned are the areas of purview of this committee. So I will quickly review those. With that, let me begin. Article 1 deals with the theme of consumer empowerment. I think everywhere you read, including the Durenberger Report, talks about the importance of consumers taking charge of their health care. There are only a certain amount of things that we can do, but what we are proposing to do is, the first item is we show by example, and that is that Dewar would be asked to bring to the table for negotiation, not necessarily to come out, because that'll be up to the negotiation process, but at least to bring to the table for negotiation one of the health care options that would include health savings account as a base. The second item is an attempt to get at, if we're going to have consumers who are motivated, then they need to build good information. And the element here would say that a provider, if asked by a consumer about the cost of procedure, must provide that consumer with the range of benefit, range of payments that provider would be receiving. We're not asking them to disclose any contract because this is only a range. The third item in that Article 1 consumer empowerment is a specific area, kind of a gap in terms of expansion of benefits. So oftentimes when we buy pharmacy products, we don't really have a clue as to what the actual costs are. What this element would call for is that an explanation of benefits would be provided at the time of claim, and it would show the copay, the amount that the pharmacy was paid for it, and it can have what you might call retail price. That's Article 1. Skip now to Article 4, deals with mandates. We are about third in the nation with over 40 mandates. And you can argue what the percentage is, but I think there's agreement at all levels that there is an impact on healthcare costs. So we're trying to at least get something rolling. The first thing that we do is call for a mandate moratorium for until 2007 that there would be no additional mandates. The second thing is to reactivate with some new language the employer alternative benefit plan, which would allow a kind of a no benefit or minimum benefit options in the small employer market to be offered only by health plans that have less than 10% of the healthcare business. And then finally, to repeal one of the mandates that is acknowledged, I think, in all of the technical community, to be at best no value, at worst, in many cases, to actually be dangerous to people, and there have been deaths attributed. And that's the autologous bone marrow transplant with high-dosage chemotherapy. There's only one element.
Chairman Bradley, we'll pick up on Article 5 in a second. I'll officially call the meeting to order. We have a quorum. Representative Pugh moves the minutes of Thursday, February 19th. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes prevail. Now, Chairman Bradley, I'm going to move House File 1681 to be recommended, passed, and sent to the Committee on Government Operations. I'm also going to move to get the bill in the shape that the author desires. I will move the H1681A25 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now the bill is in the shape that the author would like. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We move now into Article 5, and in Article 5 there's only one item that is relevant to this committee, and that calls upon the Department of Commerce and others to review currently required reports. Of course, the objective being that if there are reports that are currently required that are not used, that are not useful, that we can save the energy and hopefully ultimately get rid of some. But at this step, it would only be a study. Article 6, in its entirety, is relevant to this community, for this committee. The first item there is kind of an extension of something that we have done in the past where we have file in use, that means put into practice right away with kind of a retrospective review of the rates. This only talks about the forms, which I think would be even less controversial than when we passed the rates. The second item that we would propose to help improve competition in the marketplace is to remove the restrictions of for-profit HMOs. The third item is a deeming kind of an item. This says that health plans that are recognized and accredited by nationally recognized bodies, that would have standing for state accreditation. The fourth would allow health plans to not have to send out paper where the consumer wishes or is willing to accept it in electronic email kinds of forms. And then the fifth item is one, actually it's a proposal that's been before the legislature before, and that would be to move the remaining health insurance, which is strictly the HMO regulation that currently sits in the Department of Health, and to move that to the Department of Commerce so that we would have consolidation. And I would just tell you briefly, we do have support from both the Department of Health and the Department of Commerce. Article 7 deals with cost shifting. I believe you have a chart in your package that shows at least one example of the degree of shifting that goes on because of the underpayment by our public assistance programs, and ultimately yours and my consumers and our constituents are the ones who pay for that. So the first thing that we call for in that article is that there would be a fiscal note analysis required if there is a proposal that would bear on additional cost shifting. The second item would say that we should have no further expansion of eligibility unless we fix, and fix means in this case that we would pay providers at least at the cost level. We're not asking to necessarily pay at market level, but at least at the cost recovery level. And the third would be a study, a more comprehensive study of the phenomenon of cost shifting. Mr. Chairman, it is an attempt, hopefully in a kind of a very thorough way. We had 12 hearings around the state. We've visited with every stakeholder that has any kind of bearing to try to come together with a set of recommendations, and I'm very appreciative of this committee's opportunity to review these proposals, and if we're ready to proceed with testimony, I'm ready.
Thank you. Representative Pugh.
Mr. Chair, could I just ask one more procedural question?
Certainly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, the procedure that we're undergoing today where we don't look at Articles 2 and 3 is a little bit unique, and I suspect it's because you've got lots of stops for this type of a bill. The hearing in civil law tomorrow will actually be on another file, is that correct? It's not this bill that'll be transmitted to civil law, but it's another bill that incorporates Articles 2 and 3, is that correct?
Chairman Bradley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pugh, it includes Article 3. Article 3 actually stands alone. It doesn't require Article 2 because it has its own language about best practices. And in order to be able to move along, as the Chair indicated, with the pending deadline dates here, we decided to pull it out. But the plan is that we will have integrity. Whatever comes out of civil law will then ultimately come back in to the bill when we return to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. But it is a civil law issue.
Representative Pugh, Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, so I have it straight. If civil law would amend Article 3 in its hearing tomorrow, you'd pick that up, those changes. Whatever happens in civil law will be incorporated into this bill at Health and Human Services. Is that
Chairman
correct?
Bradley?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pugh, I'm sure they won't have anything to amend, but if they did, if they did, yes, I would honor that, and that's what would come back into the Health and Human Services Finance Committee.
Representative Pugh?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. For members that just arrived, I want to repeat what the schedule is here today, and I usually don't, I very seldom do this. I think I've done it once in 6 years, as I was brought to my attention earlier. But we're going to stick on a timeline here, and if it does cut off some debate, that's too bad. This has a lot of places to go, and it's got a lot of places to be heard, and of course the ultimate place where it will be heard if it makes it through the process is on the floor, where there will be hopefully no debate cut off there. But we're getting a little bogged down in Commerce Committee. We've got a very expansive agenda up through the deadlines, and we need to keep things moving and not have them bogged down here. So the people who wish to testify for the bill from 12:45 to 1, and I want to just review this for the people that just got here. People that are opposed to the bill, 1 to 1:15, exactly equal time. Members' questions, 1:15 to 1:30. 1:30 to 1:45, amendments, 1:45, the vote. And the reason I'm doing that is because at 1:45 we have folks here that are supporting the and opposing the ovarian cancer screening bill of Representative Clark and myself have that bill. As I said, members that just arrived, the A29 amendment, pull that out. We're going to be talking about that from 1:45 to 2:15. We're not going to offer that as an amendment today. So with that, how many, we're going to go with the pro side first and then the side that's opposing it next. How many people here wish to testify against the Bradley bill on the articles that we are taking up today? Okay, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to stick with the 15 minutes for the pro people and give members more time for questions and more times to discuss amendments. So we'll go till 1 o'clock with the people supporting it, and we have quite a list. First of all, on this list, is there anyone that's not a lobbyist that wishes to testify for the bill?
See you later.
we'll take them first. Okay. Representative Goodwin, procedural question here.
Yes, procedural question. I'm sorry I missed it, but why are we not doing Article 3 since this is the insurance committee and that is definitely an insurance issue, medical malpractice?
What I did here was asked Mr. Pender to go through what he thought this committee had purview on, and that's the list that you have before you there. And it's the feeling of the committee chair that the medical mal goes much, much more into the health area, into the civil law area, rather than here, because you're not talking so much about insurance here, but you're talking about limits of economic recovery that would all be the judiciary. So that's a decision that I made. So we're not doing Article 3. Okay, with that, Mr. Hickey, and then Carolyn Jones, Beth Hartwig, Bob Johnson, Catherine Commit, Dave, the guy from the Minnesota Hospital Association, and Dr. Robert from the Minnesota Medical Association. So we'll work on those names as we get closer to them. So welcome to the committee, sir. And I would like to have the testimony with no questions at this point. We are going to have an extra 15 minutes for questions and amendments. So please, members, if you have questions, have them ready, because I may get to the point at a certain time, because we have the folks from the ovarian cancer bill here, where I may have to cut some folks off, and we'll go from there. Hopefully that doesn't happen. Mr. Hickey, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. Yeah, I did want to just make some brief comments and get a chance to visit fairly extensively with you all during interim when we had the TRI hearing or whatever it was, and I just wanted to make some brief comments today, and I think that fits in good with your agenda. So, first of all, I just want to thank Representative Bradley for bringing this bill forward. It's a big effort, and a couple of the areas that we're strongly in support of and going to work closely with him are dealing with state mandates and trying to provide relief and cheaper health insurance for small employers who struggle with these mandates and just struggle with basically the aggregate phenomenon we're seeing in the market of these large double-digit increases for a good 5-6 years in a row now. And first of all, we think it's a great idea to take a time out on the mandates, that provision of the bill in Article 4. I guess when they started mandating in the 1970s or whenever they started, Mr. Chairman, everybody probably was in the state-regulated market. Well, guess what? In the last 34 years, roughly, most people aren't in the state-regulated market. And from what I've seen, at least the majority is not of private sector employers. It'd be great to get a concise number on that from someone if they're able to pull that up. But every time they pass a new mandate, it doesn't pertain to the state's largest, richest companies. It's falling on the small employers at Preston and elsewhere on University Avenue right down the street here, and it's just not fair. It's an equity issue. It's reached the point where it just should stop, so we really appreciate the fact that there's moratorium language in it. The most important provision in the bill for us is kind of a second go-around or a second bite on the apple on the small employer alternative benefit plans. It's probably one of my greatest frustrations in 1999. Representative Haas and Senator Shy passed that bill, and it was blocked by the Commissioner of Commerce at that time and the Attorney General. And this is critical. We need to provide relief to small employers from all these mandates. And there's a very controversial of maternity in there, too, that we need to try to find a way to deal with. I served on the special task force that attempted to implement that bill. One actual actuarial estimate was about 18.5% reduction for eliminating just a few mandates. There are the ones we talked about, mental health, chemical dependency, and maternity, priced at 10% by that one insurer. And so for the very small businesses that don't need maternity this year, may never need maternity because everybody is beyond childbearing ages or everyone's single and male or whatever the scenario is, and you can find a lot of them out there, this would really be a big help. And so this provision on alternative benefit plans, we need to do it in a big way this year, and we're going to be giving strong support to that. If we could, when the smoke clears, if we could end up with a bill that provides close to 20% relief to small employers, I think we can we really have accomplished something, and hopefully we'll keep the uninsured rate from ticking up. So I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. If I might mention here, too, to members and to people that are following this issue, in January we had 5 to 6 hours of testimony in the Commerce, Joint Commerce Health Committee regarding this issue. So also, I would like to let folks know, let's see here, again, that included Article 3 back then, but meeting tonight, 5:30, regarding the moisture intrusion bill. We have, I think, 3 Goodwin amendments. I'm not sure of any others. We will take those up, and it hopefully won't last that long. We'll take those amendments up and go from there. So make sure I don't say we adjourn at 2:15. Because we can't, it needs to be a recess, and I always like recess. Okay, Ms. Jones from the Chamber, if you could please provide your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carolyn Jones. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I want to thank you for this opportunity to talk about what our members cite as their number one issue for this legislative session, and that's the rising cost of health care. The Chamber's identified four ways that we believe we can help reduce health care costs and provide more affordable coverage. First, to eliminate and reduce state-imposed costs. Second, to improve competition and expand product options. Third, to engage consumers and to provide information about health care costs and quality. And then finally, to improve and reward quality health care. We think that this bill meets all four of those objectives. We support in Article 1 the efforts of this bill to support HSAs and to provide additional information to consumers about the cost of care and the cost of their prescription drugs. Article 4, reducing the government mandates, as has been said, Minnesota ranks very high in terms of the number of mandates. And we think that at a time when we are looking at health care reform, that it's just not the time to be adding new mandates to the system. We also support, as Mr. Hickey stated, the pilot project to give small employers additional options. This pilot simply allows our smallest employers to act like self-insured employers and to design and develop their own benefit sets that best meets the needs of their workforce. And then finally, the medical evidence doesn't support the use of the bone marrow mandate, and we don't think that it should be mandated by law. We support the administrative and competition reforms found in Articles 5 and 6, specifically the file and use reforms. We think that that will get things to the market quicker. We support that the for-profit HMOs, allowing them to compete as long as it's a level playing field. And then finally, a new element that was added to the bill in the Healthcare Committee, the study of the electronic data exchange system, or the implementation of it. We found that in Santa Barbara that has a similar system, they have found that it not only saves money but really improves the quality of their health care, and we think that this is a wise investment for our health care system. And then finally, we also support Article 7 on the cost shifting. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. Next, Beth Hartwood from the Minnesota Business Partnership. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Beth Hartwig, and I represent the Minnesota Business Partnership. And I'll be really brief because I'm going to be echoing a lot of what Ms. Jones and Mr. Hickey have just said. We applaud Representative Bradley for taking on this huge issue. Healthcare costs and the related issues are a growing concern for employers and employees as well. Top on the Minnesota Business Partnership's agenda are addressing cost shifting from public health care programs to private payers. So that's a top priority for us, as well as working with all stakeholders to develop broad systemic reform in the system, because we think that that's the real answer to a lot of the problems that we're facing. But we recognize the need to fix the system that we've got. So with that, we support Representative Bradley's consumer empowerment article. We think people should have choices and the ability to exercise them, and some of the options that he has in there, the health savings account, et cetera, bring that to the consumer. Article 4, the mandates, we support. We believe that health insurance mandates restrict the ability of purchasers and plans to creatively respond, and we also support the test pilot program as well. Article 5, approval of, we think that getting the products, this will help get products to the market faster and allow plans to react to consumer needs. And we also believe that the for-profit health plans is a good idea as long as the playing field is kept level. Article 7, as I said, is address cost shifting, and that's the partnership's top priority, so we applaud those efforts as well. So with that, I'll conclude my comments.
Thank you so much. Next is Bob Johnson from the Insurance Federation.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, excuse me, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. We just testify here strongly in support of House File 1681. This represents a bill, and on the three articles in particular, Articles 1, 4, and 6, that frankly are going to address one of the critical issues in this state for surely small employers and buyers, and that is not enough options. If there's one thing that small employers say, all the time is that help us enhance and improve the competitive market to give us some more choices so when we're shopping for coverage or something other than what's out there right now, which is not much. So Article 1 with HSAs, Article 4 with the alternative benefit plans, Article 6 with the for-profit HMOs, all goes to enhance increasing the number of options for buyers. I think that is an excellent result. The other changes on the regulatory authority and the filings just make state government smarter than it's been to date, and I think it should be passed because it treats the entities the same, and moving product quickly through the process should be done, and we haven't done a good enough job in Minnesota. Thank you.
Okay, next, Catherine Commit, Council of Health Plans. Representative Rucavina.
Get to ask questions?
Yes, we've got, I've got a whole schedule here. After we hear from the folks against the bill, then it's member questions, amendments, and then votes. There'll be time for questions. So people that are testifying, if you could stick around, if members have questions and want to bring you back down, we'll want you to come back down. Representative Rucavina. Where's Mr. Johnson? He's left already. Oh, we'll bring him back up during member question time. Okay, Catherine Commit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Catherine Commit of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and I've abbreviated my testimony. I just want to say that we think this is a really important bill that Representative Bradley has brought forward. There are a number of things I just want to highlight. We're very pleased in Article 1 that Representative Bradley has placed an emphasis on getting consumers more engaged in their own health care decisions regarding cost as well as quality. We also agree with the language in Article 1 to help consumers understand better what the true cost of prescription drugs are. In Article 2, we support Representative Bradley's efforts to stem the growth of government-imposed costs in the form of benefit mandates. I also just want to briefly mention that we appreciate the language that he's included in the bill that attempts to streamline the multitude of reports that are now required by state agencies in the healthcare system. We think that this is an effort that is being supported both in the House, the Senate, and the governor also supports this. We also agree with many of the provisions in Article 6. The language that was just approved in the amendment will be very helpful in terms of reducing administrative duplication, both at the state agency level and at the health plan level. I want to also just make a brief mention of the technical assistance that we received from the staff at DHS, the Department of Health, and Commerce to develop this language. It's a positive development and think it will help with reducing health care costs. Just have one section of the bill that we've talked with Representative Bradley about before. We, as an organization that represents 8 nonprofit health plans in Minnesota, do not support the provision to allow for-profit health plans. However, we continue to work with Representative Bradley, and I'm sure we'll have more discussions. We also just want to say that we are supportive of the language that allows health plans to offer customers the opportunity to access information through electronic means. We appreciate the language that dealing with the transfer of regulatory jurisdiction of HMOs from health to commerce. In our view, it makes sense to house all of the regulatory functions within one agency and will be more efficient. I think it's important to start looking at cost shifting, and the study in particular is an important step in that direction. In summary, Representative Bradley has crafted a very good bill to engage health plans, hospitals, physicians, and consumers to begin to address the growth in healthcare spending, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Okay, with that, it's 1 o'clock. We're going to note for the record that David Feinwax and Dr. Robert Meeches, one's from the Minnesota Hospital Association, one's from the Minnesota Medical Association, we're here to testify in support of the bill. If you have anything in writing, we will get it passed out. Now we will spend some time. We do have someone that wishes to testify against the bill. Twyla Brace, if you could please come down and give us your testimony. The members that have just arrived, again, while Twyla's coming down, at 1:15 or before, we will have members' questions, and then by 1:45 we will have worked on the amendments and be voting on the bill. Because at 1:45 we have folks here for the ovarian cancer screening bill that have taken their days off work and are going to be talking to us about the amendment 829 that we've pulled and will not be offered to the bill today. Okay, with that, welcome to committee, please, and please remember, please state your name and who you represent for the record, and we're only talking about the articles that we mentioned.
Right, I understand that. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm from Citizens Council on Healthcare. I'm not totally coming to oppose the bill. There are some very good things in the bill, and I'm going to mention them to you. Section 1, the state employees getting access to health savings account. We do have some, that's one. I'm just going to say as well that I have a few questions to just throw out. In Section 2, the disclosure of payments for health care services.
We're not doing, yeah, Section 2. Thank you. Okay, thank you. Yep.
It's interesting that the consumer doesn't include welfare recipients. And one of our concerns, and I realize that you're not going to be looking at Article 2, but Article 2 deals with financial incentives that
we're
are given
talking
to
about
providers.
Article 2.
I understand that.
Article 2. So let's talk about what we're talking about, please.
However, what this says is disclosure of payments for health care services. So if there are financial incentives, I'm wondering if those financial incentives for payment of health care services from Article 2 are part of the disclosure in this section. And it's not clear that they are. The other thing that I would say is that this could prevent welfare recipients. Well, this isn't a good idea for welfare recipients as well not to be considered consumers and not to be given access to the information about what their providers are being paid to take care of them. So it seems that it's a limited idea for consumers. And in Section 3, access to discounted provider fees, discounted fees don't always cover the cost. And so I think that patients and enrollees will no doubt take comfort in this language. But we're a little concerned that by putting it into statute, it could be a form of price control. So I just want to point that out. That if it is a form of price control, that's probably something that the state shouldn't probably be involved in. And then it's a very good idea in Section 4 to have the payment disclosure on the pharmaceutical products. As a matter of fact, on our WCCO Patients Perspective radio program, that was one of the things that the callers called in to say, because she had found an enormous amount of money that had been transferred elsewhere. Section 5 is conforming the state law to the federal health savings account law, which we think is a very good idea. Article 4 has the reducing mandates and allowing mandate-free health insurance policies, which is also a great idea, as well as allowing for-profit HMOs, although we, of course, would like to see more options just besides for-profit HMOs, but it's good to open it up to competition. And then Section 7 in Article 4, we'd just like to make sure that the enrollee doesn't miss this notice regarding whether or not they're going to have electronic
here,
or not.
Here, Ms. Grace, you said Article
4,
Section 7?
Section 7.
Why is that not on our list here? Excuse me?
Is that the wrong article?
Are you Article 6, Ms. Brace?
I'm sorry, I forgot to bring the bill. It has to do with the electronic notification from the health plans.
Where's that?
Article 6, Section 4.
Article
6. Okay. Okay, Article 6, Section 4. Okay, please proceed.
Great.
Members, Article 6, Section 4. 7. Where's 7?
So we would just like to make sure that the enrollees cannot miss this notice and that it's perhaps a separate notice or something that's not deeply ingrained in whatever other papers that they receive. And then Section 8, changing the authority to the Department of Commerce, is a very good idea. And then Article 7, hopefully I have the right one there, on cost shifting, it's a very good idea to look at this and to, the only thing is that we think it's important to clarify if the price of the service or the discounted payment will be considered the reimbursement rate in the study. So, those are our comments. I've provided the members of the committee anything that they might want to think about when it comes to the financial incentives with guidelines, and that's why I have distributed our draft report on guidelines, practice guidelines, which is in Article 2.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. Okay, with that, members, I believe since I pulled 29 and we already put the Bradley Amendment on, I don't see that I have any amendments, so we'll take the entire remaining time till 1:45, unless we finish earlier, for member questions. But at 1:45, we'll be voting on it. And remember, members, please remember this bill has a long ways to go. It's challenging me for the record of most committees stopped at, but I don't think you'll ever break that. It was 16 with my teacher health plan bill last year. And they said that's going to go to 30 committees this year, and we only have 26. So I'm not sure how that's going to work. So with that, I have on my list Representative Rukovina, Goodwin, and folks that have testified, if you could please come forward if a member has a question for you. And then at 1:45, we're on the clerk David's ovarian cancer screening amendment, which we won't vote on today because we don't have the bill before us. But we do have the people to testify on that. So with that, Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, I had a specific question for Mr. Johnson, but I'll pass for now.
Okay, Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several questions, actually. First, I'm glad this bill has to go to a number of committees. I hope it gets a very, very good analysis because there's major, major changes in this bill to Minnesota's health care system, and this should not be done lightly whatsoever. I'm a little sorry we don't have more time in this committee to discuss this bill and hear from the public on it because I'm not sure too many people know out in the public yet what's going on here. One question I have for Representative Bradley is the Durenberger Committee, the Governor's Committee on Healthcare, just finished their report yesterday. Your bill was prepared a couple of months ago. What in your bill coordinates with the Governor's Committee that came out with their report yesterday?
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Goodwin. I've been in regular correspondence with Senator Durenberger all the way through, even before we crafted this bill. If you look at the emphasis in the Durenberger report on best practices, I think we're very consistent. If you look at sort of the consumer information parts, we're also very consistent. From what I see of the core values, and actually Senator Durenberger's words to me, were that all the way along, we have been pretty darn consistent with what the Durenberger findings were. The reason that we started earlier, frankly, was that I felt we couldn't wait until the next legislative session to start the ball rolling. That was very important to make some progress this session. And what we did, by the way, as far as whether or not the public, we had a total of 11 hours of hearings. We had 12 sites around the state that we visited, made presentations. In Rochester, for example, we had 50 people from the public that were there with comments. So we have not at all. I mean, this has been available to people in every kind of forum, and I've been contacted from all over the state. So I there's been no attempt to hide anything. As a matter of fact, I think we've done everything in our power to engage the public, and the public responded. I mean, we heard a lot of great feedback.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Goodwin.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, what I heard about the public meetings that went around the state is that none of the public comments were incorporated into your bill, only the comments from the medical and insurance industries. And to me, that's kind of apparent in this bill because I worked in the medical field for 14, 15 years. I'm analyzing these different parts and trying to figure out what this is going to do for the consumer. I don't see how it's going to reduce the cost for the consumer. I see how it's going to reduce the liability for the insurance industry. But again, the insurance industry has said they're not going to pass that savings on to the physicians in the form of lower malpractice rates. I see where we're going to cut mandates, including mental health care, in insurance policies. I have grave concerns about that because of children's mental health that I worked in and adult mental health. I see that it doesn't really do anything to reduce the cost to the consumer, but it does reduce the benefits to the consumer. It may eventually do something to reduce the cost, but it also doesn't do anything to cover the 138,000 people that were dropped off Minnesota Care last year. So it doesn't, unless the small businesses pick up some, are able to get health care through this, but I understand that the program that you're proposing here has already been in law in the past and they haven't taken advantage of that. I think it's a huge issue and I think it deserves a lot of discussion, and I'm not seeing that it's going to have enough in this short session. The one thing that I've looked at in the past is the fee-for-service system of medical care, and I'm trying to find out why it's so impossible, nearly impossible, very, very difficult for a consumer that doesn't have health insurance to price compare. for example, you should be able to walk into a physician's office or call a physician and say, how much would it cost for a physical? How much would it cost for a glucose tolerance test and so forth? You can't do that because I did a study of this in 1985, and I've just talked to people in the medical industry, and they told me it's still that way. They'll tell you, call our business office at such and such a number, and they'll tell you that you cannot walk into the doctor's office, for example, and get a list of their fees. And I know from the work I've done in the medical field that every procedure has a fee. Every procedure, it could be listed in a pamphlet, for example, and handed to the consumer. I think that's one of the reasons our medical costs have gone so high, because it's almost impossible for people to compare costs, and people want to do that. And we always hear from the medical field it's because people shouldn't be thinking about cost when they're ill. Well, people have to think about cost, especially those people that don't have insurance. So what I would like to see in your bill is a mandate that clinics and physicians have to have information readily available to the public about their costs for different procedures. And I think that would be something that would probably help reduce health care costs more than most things that are going on in this bill.
We also have
Mr. Chairman.
Did you respond to that?
Please, yeah. Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin. First of all, then you should applaud on page 2, section 2, the required disclosure of payment range. That's exactly what's in the bill. So you should like that. Let me also make a correction. $138,000 Minnesota Care is not correct. It was $38,000, and that's over 5 years. So it's not quite what you're saying. As a matter of fact, if you look at the use of medical savings accounts as an indication, the HSA, the health savings account, is a much superior tool. About 70 to 80% of people that have used that tool were previously uninsured. And I think it's a great opportunity. What that tool is going to do is to allow people who previously could not get before tax benefits to acquire that. So this really is about tools to help people. And then as far as the objective of reducing costs, I mean, members, that's the only reason that I put in all the hours that I have put on this. I mean, with all due respect to the people who have testified, I don't really care about them. What I care about is how much the people that you and I represent are paying in their premiums, their co-pays and deductibles. And you can disagree. That's up to you. I mean, that's certainly fine. But I will tell you from the very beginning that this is all about doing the things that will in the end yield lower premiums, or at least not as rapidly increasing the premiums as we've seen in the past. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I've got Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bradley, in Article 6, I think it's Section 1, you have put into the bill something that in the insurance company is called file and use forms. And I'm sure I will compliment you knowing that most of the time, most every time I've ever asked you about your bill, you actually read it and understand the whole bill. So file and use form gives the insurance companies an awful lot of leeway in the ability to just say, hey, this is what we're going to sell, and we don't have to send anything or talk to the Commerce Department at all. I know your heart is in the right place with trying to help consumers, but to give insurance companies carte blanche and not have any oversight by the Commerce Department doesn't seem like it really helps consumers. We had this particular fight. Another member of this committee brought forth a bill with file and use last year on almost everything, and it didn't get out of this committee, fortunately. Can you give me some reasons as to why you think file and use is a better way to go rather than having the Commerce Division oversee the policy before it gets sold to the public?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, the Commerce Department is not entirely out of the picture. As a matter of fact, in places that have had file and use for rates, most places have not used it, to be perfectly honest, because they're afraid of the retrospective impact that the Department of Commerce can have on them, because there still is the power to overturn that, and it would be very embarrassing because you have to send letters out to the people that have policies in your company, those kinds of things. What this does is it allows when the company realizes, no, we're talking about forms in this case, we're not talking about rates, so I think it's even more safe. But I believe that the Department of Commerce still retains the right after the fact that if they think that something's been abused, they can impose sanctions on the company. So I don't see it being abused. As a matter of fact, it may be even that it works better, because there still is power. But what it does allow to happen is, instead of waiting several months sometimes for the bureaucracy to move, and we could argue maybe the bureaucracy should move faster, but there's been experiences like that, to be able to move quickly when you want to get something to the marketplace that's an advantage for the consumer.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, that's all well and good in theory. In the preparation last year I did for the file and use forms, it was not the case where the fines that were levied against insurance companies were of substantial value that they thought it was. The consumer advocates pretty much said that they were, pretty clearly he said it was just chump change, so to speak. And I talked to a number of them across the country. But then again, the biggest problem is that with this file in use on the forms is that, you know, I've got a health care benefit plan and all the things, and I filed all my forms, and I'm substantially not covered or rejected or have a particular problem. And as we've seen in another bill, lawyers and insurance companies can certainly overwhelm consumers to the point where they just give up. And that's probably what's going to happen if there's an argument between a consumer and a large medical insurance company with, you know, 1,000 lawyers on retainer just waiting for something to do, and a consumer's got to spend $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 to fight them, if for no other reason, I'd probably have to vote against the bill just on the file and use part of it. So I'll give you that, and you can answer that as you like. I have another question, though, unless you've got something you want to speak to.
To that point, Representative Wilkins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yes, I don't quite.
I like that.
Wow.
That is a frightening slip.
frightening, I'm sure.
frightening. That's right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney. I don't know where you get the 1,000 lawyers that they have to go against. It's a simple call to the Department of Commerce. If a bill is not complying with the law, the insurance companies still have to comply with the law. This is simply a speed-to-market issue. I'll give you an example. I had a call, I think it was about 2 years ago, from Farm Bureau, which used to be actually located in my district, believe it or not. They had have a facility in Eagan. And there's an agent there that was saying he's got insurance coming up for expirations on policies that are no longer being offered. And the new policies hadn't been approved yet by the Department of Commerce. There was some foot dragging, and it was just taking an incredible amount of time. This would make it so that if you're an insurance company, you file a policy. You're required to file ones that comply with the law. Your interest is to have them comply with the law, whether there's penalties or whatever. Whether they're consequential penalties or severe penalties, your incentive is to do forms that comply with the law, because you're going to be out there in the market selling policies, and if you're having to go back and correct policies to comply with the law, you're not selling. It's very expensive to the insurance company, and they don't have an incentive to not comply. And I like to know, are there states where this has been a problem? Because there's a lot of states that have file and use. It's becoming more and more prevalent. And I've never seen it in my experience in the industry as ever having been a problem.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wilkins, you know, I don't do insurance. I just call up some of the more common places that we get information on, and we do get the conversation is that it's that is the problem, that insurance companies have been known to use more lawyers than really are probably necessary. No offense to the lawyer
lawyers in this particular room.
From Chicago?
Well, they'd at least use the phrase correctly, sir.
Okay.
As I instructed you how to do it. So.
Yes, I made a slight error there.
But your question about my bigger concern is, and your concern with your agent that called you, is that, as I remember, and again, I you know, this is a year ago, they have 30 or 60 days after submission, the Commerce Department has 30 or 60 days after submission to return the policy or to give a written explanation as to why, and then the insurance company has a similar time period, 30 or 60 days, to respond to that. And one of the problems is that over the years we've been cutting staff in that particular department in the Commerce Division so that that does back up, and those letters don't get out until the end of that particular time frame. But it's a dual blame for the insurance companies and the Commerce Division, because both take forever to get their letters back in for it. And then neither one are really serving the public. But that's my take on it, and I'm sure you have a different take on it. My concern here, and I'll ask this of Representative Bradley, is are you requiring these forms to be submitted to the Commerce Division, and at what point are they supposed to be submitted? Are they supposed to be submitted at time of sale or prior to sale or upon call? Because last year the bill came through with those forms did not have to be brought to the Commerce Division unless there was a complaint. And then they had X number of days or weeks to get those forms to the Commerce Division. So I'd like an explanation of how that is going to be used.
So that's a good question, Mr. Mahoney. I see Bob Johnson coming down, or maybe Mr. Pender. Mr. Johnson, can you explain how that works, the Mahoney question here?
Mr. Chairman, on page 16 of the bill, the line paragraph B of 62A02 sub 2 has to be can't be used. It has to be filed at the same time as it's used, but it has to be filed. And that's different from a year ago. There was some discussion, and there's other forms of filing, including today in Minnesota, where they don't have to be filed at all. That is not what this is. This continues the filing requirement. And in fact, the way this current law is worded, then there's a 60-day time frame within which, if the agency kicks the red flag out, the filing then comes to the table, and then they're going to engage in the discussion about fixing the filing. That's how this would work.
To that point, Representative Rukovina, Representative Mahoney, you still have the floor. Representative Mahoney, sorry.
And Mr. Chair, is the Commerce Division here at all?
Is anyone here from the Commerce Department? Okay. I almost was there.
Yeah.
But
the key word was almost.
Almost. Mr. Pender?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm kind of surprised that we have a huge insurance bill here and no one from Commerce. That must have been a slip on your aide's part to not notify him, right?
No, my aides don't make mistakes. I take full responsibility. But we don't need the Commerce Department here necessarily if we have Mr. Pender, because
Mr. Chair,
to that point, Mr. Rukovina.
I'm absolutely stunned.
And that's a lot.
Talking about a major bill dealing with a lot of insurance issues, and there's nobody from the department that controls insurance companies in the state. I mean, that speaks, I think, very appropriately to this bill.
They thought it was so clean they didn't need to be here. Representative Rukovina.
I have another area.
Okay, Representative Mahoney, then Representative Rukovina. But just a second here. Just wait, going too fast here for me. Mr. Pender, Mr. Johnson, if you look at page 16, it says health plan form, health plan forms. So that they would have to be filed, and then they could be used. So they would be on file. Now, we're talking just on health plans here. We're not talking about auto, homeowners, life. This is health plan forms only. But they would have to be filed at the time or before they're used. Mr. Pender?
At that point?
Or Mr. Pender, then Representative Goodwin, to that point.
Mr. Chair, That's correct. The law would require that the form be filed before it would be used. And you can see here on page 16, lines 24 to 31, it sets out what happens. On lines 27 to 28 on page 16, for instance, it says may be used on or after the date of filing with the commissioner. So it would have to be filed before it's used. And then it goes on to say that the forms that are not approved or disapproved within the 60-day period are deemed approved. That's what we call a 60-day deemer clause. And so that's the way this works, that they would not be, if they were disapproved during the 60-day period, then the insurance company would have to stop selling that particular form, and they would have to revise the forms that they've already sold during that time because they would have been sold illegally. And in fact, there's a provision in law that says that every health insurance policy that's sold has to contain language something like this, that this policy is required to comply with Minnesota law, and if anything in here does not comply with Minnesota law, it's considered automatically amended to comply. So there's sort of a little fail-safe there for policy forms.
Thank you, Mr. Pender. Representative Goodwin, to that point, and Representative Mahoney still has the floor. Representative Goodwin.
To that point, I guess for either Mr. Johnson or Representative Bradley, how does it lower insurance rates to go from prior approval of increases in rates to file and use of the rates for services? How does that lower the cost of health insurance? And in addition to that question, do you have lists of those states that are a prior approval versus file and use, and how their rates rank with ours in Minnesota?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, my comment would be that of the provisions in the bill, this goes to the environment within which insurance companies are operating. We have a dysfunctional health insurance environment in Minnesota, greatly diminished competition. One of the problems historically has been an agency where to get filings through, it's taken too long a time. And so it's affected the number of competitors in the marketplace. That would be my comment. So changing the law in this case doesn't amend the law. You still have to comply with the law. And Mr. Pender referenced the statute that conforms it no matter what. This goes to trying to improve the competitive environment. That's how I read it. It doesn't vary the law. And as you look at other states have much more competitive health insurance environments for surely their small employers than we do. And I believe this is an effort to try to improve and enhance that environment. So it's not just a pure cost issue. It's a competitive issue in the marketplace.
Some good one.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I've traveled around this country a lot, and I haven't seen anybody not complaining about health care and health insurance in any state in the nation. So I don't know where you get your information about how it's so much better in other states as for self-employed or small business. So I'd have to see something in writing to believe that. But quite frankly, I can't see how, when you have to get prior approval to increase your rates, so that takes a little more time. That little more time helps the consumer. You're already going up double digits every year in the cost of health insurance. Double digits every year for many years, not just for the last 3 or 4 years. So how in the world can you say that it helps the consumer in any way? Of course you want to. What you want to do is increase your rates faster. That's the bottom line here in this provision. You want to increase your rates faster.
To that point, this is not about rates, it's about forms. There's a big difference there. But go ahead.
Okay, well, no, it's about getting prior approval for rate increases, which they have to do now.
That's not what this is about.
That's current law.
That's current law. You can already do that. This is the forms, approving forms so they can bring products to market.
For new products, like, can you explain that?
A new health plan, a new accident plan. Well, this would just be health plans.
Health plans.
Health plans, yeah.
New.
So it's not rates, it's just the forms that they can get. What slowed things down so many times in the past is a form will go to the Department of Commerce and it'll sit there for 2 years. And so if the company wants to bring their policy in, they can't do it. It doesn't matter what the rate is. They can't get the policy in because they can't get the form approved. And there have been examples of 2 years, might be 6 months, a year, but by then the market's changed, they need to go on to something else. So that's, Mr. Johnson, that's kind of what we're looking at here. But right. Representative Goodwin, you still have the floor.
Oh, okay. Then I do want to clarify that. Thank you for...
You've got the floor, and then we're going to that point, we're going to go to Gunther, and then back to Goodwin.
I'm sorry.
You, and then to Mallory. To that point?
I don't know what that point is.
You're on the list. I think you got time. Go ahead.
Okay, I guess I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I made a mistake there, I apologize for that. I just want to know then, is it true right now, and even if this bill passes, that they need prior approval for rate increases? Is that the situation right now?
Mr. Pender?
I'm so glad you're here.
Mr. Chair and Representative Goodwin, the law as we changed it a few years ago makes the health plan rates file and use.
Okay.
So that's already in place, and this is adding to that the forms.
Thank you.
Representative Goodwin. Okay, to that point, Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, with this bill allowing to not have filing use and allowing this new product to come onto the market as fast as possible, are we increasing competition or are we increasing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, I view this as a plus to enhance and improve the competitive environment.
Representative Gunther?
Could bring lower costs. Generally it does. Cups versus rainbow versus something like Sam's Club, whatever. You see it all the time. So just out of curiosity, if we're not having to go through this formal process, getting something there quicker, it could mean cost savings. And after all, are these products that are being bought to Minnesota new products, or are they already in other states?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, these are companies that are in other states that are not here.
So some other commerce or insurance commission has already reviewed these and made them saleable and acceptable in other states.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, yes, they're being sold in South Dakota and Wisconsin and Ohio.
Might not be a good example.
Well, it's close by. There are a number of states that these products are being sold by companies that are not being sold here, and those same products have been approved.
So, Mr. Gunther, magic or great amount of intelligence that other states don't have in this regard?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, we've had some history here that has affected and diminished the competition. I think this is an attempt to try to reverse some of it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, back to the person that actually has the floor, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bradley, it was noted earlier that this will affect the mental health coverage. One of my bigger concerns, and having just been on a tour of one of the state prisons and reminded myself of the fact that about 80% of our crimes are committed by chemically dependent people, how will this, and much of the workplace accidents happen because of chemicals and drugs and alcohol, you name it, they're the scourge of many issues here. How will your bill affect chemical dependency treatment? Over the last 20 years, we've seen it go from 30 days inpatient to 30 days outpatient, to 14 days outpatient, to 7 days outpatient, to best of luck, see you later. You know, where are we heading with this?
Representative Bradley?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, if you track through the bill, this is only, you might almost call this pilot, because this is for the small employer and for the less than 10% of business. I mean, we have three companies and health plans that own 85% of the business in Minnesota. So it's very, very restricted in that respect. Secondly, the plan, and this is a minimum or no mandate kind of option that they would be allowed to do, except that if you read the language, it still involves the Commissioner of Commerce. So it's not a free rein in this. Plus, of course, I mean, now you're making a decision for your employers. I mean, anybody who enters into this, the examples that were given, and I don't know that I would have included the examples that were included in it, but what that really says is that you're giving an employer an option to use a plan that has now been previously approved by the Department of Commerce, some creativity in terms of what fits your employer set. Now, I don't know that that would ever include mental health. I mean, as I said, I wouldn't necessarily use that example. but it does allow flexibility to offer a plan for people to pick up insurance that probably wouldn't have any insurance if they have to pay a normal full rate for a plan that doesn't fit them.
Representative Mahoney?
So what you're saying is you're not sure that this would or wouldn't cover anything with the chemical dependency, and the person goes to work one morning and tries to get chemical dependent, you know, tries to get treatment for this particular ailment, the employer could just as easily say, you know, that's not in our plan, and just like pregnancy or skiing down Vail and breaking your leg, or it's just not in the plan.
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, let me try on something else for size. We've got two sides of the street. On one side of the street, 70% of Minnesota's population resides. On the other side, 30%. On the side where 70% reside, there's already no mandates except for federal. These are self-insured ERISA. We have our state laws don't apply to any of those people that's on that side of the street. So, I mean, I'm not sure which constituents you might be speaking to, but we already have cases. What we've been doing in Minnesota is placing an extraordinary burden of mandates on that 30%. And as we do it, more and more of the people in that 30% who have a chance take the risk and go self-insured to escape it so that they can get lower-cost products. So at least you ought to keep that in mind as we think about, well, do you do it for this or don't you do it for that? In that case, the market, except for a few mandates on the federal level, the market controls it.
Representative Mahoney?
No.
Okay, I have Representative Rukavina, Mullery, then Vandiver, and members, in 7 minutes, I'm going to do something that's just going to kill me. I'm going to cut off debate, and we're going to vote, and then we're going to bring the ovarian cancer people up. That yes. You want to testify to that bill. Okay, Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, and my friend, Mr. Olson,
the other Mr. Olson.
Larry Darrell and his other brother Bob. Yeah. Mr. Johnson.
You know, a decade and a half ago, I heard you talk about the fact that, you know, no one was going to write workers' comp insurance in this state because the injured workers were utilizing workers' compensation. Last week, we heard you say that nobody's going to write homeowners insurance because too many homeowners are using homeowners insurance. Now you're in support of this bill. I guess I can only assume that if the Insurance Federation is supporting Representative Bradley's bill, you're anticipating nobody will be able to use their health insurance. is that a logical, illogical conclusion, I guess, or a logical approach to that?
That'd be like Wolf three times.
Because, you know, I don't see anywhere in this bill where the insurance industry has to pass anything up. I know we're not supposed to talk about Article 3, is it, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
But I mean, actually, you know, we are in the Commerce Committee, and the administration that regulates insurance in this state is within the purview of this policy committee. And so I have to, you know, I look at these limits on medical malpractice lawsuits, and everybody in this committee knows that, you know, lawyers aren't my favorite people, but they're a necessary evil in society. But I don't see anywhere in here, Representative Bradley, where you're limiting the insurance company's attorneys. It's the same old story. It's just like workers' comp. We limited what the workers' comp attorney defending an injured worker could get, but we never limited what an insurance company hiring a hired gun, high-powered Philadelphia lawyer could pay that attorney. Where are you guaranteeing here that any of these cost savings you're anticipating, which I would argue there aren't going to be any, but where do you mandate that these get passed back on to this doctor that you're trying to help out by limiting these malpractices?
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rucavino, I'd have to go back to show you a current law where we have loss ratios in law. We have approvals. Even if it's a file in use, the Department of Commerce still has a financial responsibility to review very carefully these companies. They are under very tight regulations as far as what they're allowed to do. Well, so I didn't think I had to add to that.
Mr. Chair, you know, I'm probably looking around this table. Other than Karen Clark, I'm the only person in this room that was here in 92, I think.
I was.
Yeah, but you weren't a player then. Nobody
anyway. I was earning my stripes.
Do you have any bills coming up before this
committee? In the 92 workers' comp bill, Mr. Johnson, you remember this quite well. We mandated a 15% cut minimum, and we made everybody in that system, the injured worker, take a 5% cut, the insurance company reduced 5%, and I think the QRCs and doctors and expert witnesses and all the other, you know, people in that system. Remember, we did that.
Wasn't that 95?
92. 95 was a terrible bill.
Oh.
Yeah, Mr. Johnson. Because people are selling workers' comp insurance again in the state, and nobody can benefit from it, but that's a whole other story. So, Representative Bradley, I don't see it in here. And I'm curious, now that Mr. Johnson is still here, Mr. Johnson, where in this bill do we limit how much insurance companies can sue each other? Because insurance companies are suing each other all the time in this country. And is there anything in here where one insurance company defending someone who has something done to them in an operation where that insurance company trying to recover damages or whatever can limit how much they sue another insurance company, a dollar amount or attorney's fees or anything else?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rucavina, I think in the bill, I know it's not before the committee, the Med-Mal reforms don't have those kinds of provisions in them as you asked, but I guess I'd like to state that I have been fairly critical of the tort liability system, period. And its inefficiency, its failure to produce results, and it costing a lot of money on both sides, and I quickly add, the defense costs in that system are about equivalent to the plaintiff lawyer's costs. So both sides are taking out about the same amount out of each dollar that goes in the tort system. So, you know, in that sense, there's an equality of that. And I've been critical of the whole thing as being an inefficient, poor way to resolve a lot of disputes. But I know the time's not there, but there's a lot in there. I don't know if you wanted questions on that. But the work comp market is healthy and competitive. And it was in 92 and 95. And you're right, 92 had a 16% mandated rate reduction. It was actually a point higher than you recall. But then let me state the 95 bill did not have a mandated cost reduction, and it saved more dollars in the system through voluntarily reduced rate filings by the companies in the ensuing 5 years than did the 92 mandated rate reduction, period. And that is, it's on the record. It can be demonstrated. It's absolutely the truth. If costs are affected in a system and there is a competitive market, the competitive market will reflect the cost savings. I believe that the track record that can be proved time and again in this state, in auto, in homeowners, in work comp, liability, and that's the way, if you believe in competitive markets, that is the way they work, and the track record can be proven in this state that that's the case.
Well, Senator Rucavina?
I mean, I don't want to argue this with you, but no one can. I mean, what we did in the 95 bill would certainly have lowered workers' comp insurance rates because we don't allow the injured worker anymore really to benefit from the workers' comp system in this state. If you want true capitalism, which my friends on the other side, I'm not a believer in true capitalism, you all know that. Let's just lift the insured and the mandate that an injured worker can't sue.
And we'll leave that at that because it's 145, and I'm going to be.
Chair, what am I saying?
Yes, sir.
On the bill. Representative Bradley, you know, I see you have a whole list here of testifiers that came, but I don't see any consumers, and I don't really think this is a consumer bill at all. I think it's an insurance bill and a bill for the chamber and for the business partnership, and that's what I think it is. I don't think it's going to help any sick people or people in general, the populace in general, get cheaper insurance. But where is your bill in the Senate, and what are its chances?
Bradley?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rucavina, we have an author actually for both the full bill as well as the medical mal. I can't predict what will happen. I mean, it's there. Senator Bergman and I were in Denver together on an NCSL thing, worked together. We have a lot of areas in common that we agree. And sooner or later, all these ideas are going to have to come together, and we're going to have to conference a health care bill. Something needs to come out of this legislative session. And whether I win all these things, or we, I should say, win all these things, and I really do believe, by the way, that it's our consumers who are going to benefit in the end, because if we take costs out of the system, eventually that is going to have some bearing on our consumers. But the bills are there. There are authors. I don't know what Senator Bergman and Senator Betzer will do as far as hearings in their committees.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Bradley and Representative Rukavina. I'm going to be equally discriminatory in that I have Representative Mallory and Vandebeer that we're going to have to cut off here, one from each side. So with that being said, I will renew my motion to House File 1681 as the amendment be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on GovOps. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Division of hands. It's pretty close, sir. All in favor? Aye. Raise your right hand. And Committee Legislative Assistant count.
Can't figure out.
Logan
sets the hands up.
Mr.
Chairman,
can
we raise our left hands?
Against, raise your left hands. Okay, 16 ayes, 11 nays. The bill passes. Thank you, Representative Bradley. Members, now, item next, if you could please take out what was the 829 amendment. Thank you, Representative Bradley. And thank you, members and testifiers and all the people that are interested in this bill. Now, I believe it was last September, and if you could take out the 829 amendment, we'll be getting a bill to this committee. We have people here today to testify, and Representative Clark is going to kind of manage the testimony here. This is a Davids-Clark bill. I believe it was this last September. I was driving down the road listening to Minnesota Public Radio, as I usually do. And the governor came out saying that he may be supporting an ovarian cancer screening mandate bill, and I about drove off the road. I couldn't believe it. And so at that point, I went right to work. Is Minnesota? Yeah, it was. I went right to work and drafted a bill, and of course, come to find out, Representative Clark had a very similar bill in, and so I said, why don't we get together and work on this together and see what kind of language we could move forward. Now, the bill we just had that was passed out of here had a mandate moratorium, and so that's one idea out there. Another idea out there is to work on this ovarian cancer mandate bill that Representative Clark has been so gracious to work on with me. And so what I'd like to do at this point is have Representative Clark make a few remarks, and then we'll have testimony from, we're very fortunate today to have with us Dr. Patricia Judson, U of M Gynecology Oncology Department, Laura Solars from the Minnesota Ovarian Cancer Alliance, and a Catherine Murphy from the Minnesota Cancer Resource Center. Am I correct? Oh, I'm not.
No.
Okay. Where did I goof up?
That's right. I'll be whoever you want me to be.
The chairman.
Okay, did I get two of the three right? That's not bad.
Rain Snyder. Dr. Judson, Laura Solars, and Rain Snyder.
So not a Catherine Murphy?
Yes, she's here too.
Oh, she's here too. Oh, cool. Okay, so I'm sorry. How do you spell your first name?
It's the last half of Lorraine, R-A-I-N-E.
Cool.
Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R.
And who do you represent?
Ovarian cancer survivors.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, great. Okay, Representative Clark, if you kind of want to manage the discussion here, that would be wonderful.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I really want to thank Chair Davids, first of all, for allowing this bill to come before you. And I guess it will be a separate bill this time, and that's great. And I think this one should be one that will be a bipartisan bill as it passes through. And I come before you in a role that I don't usually have, which is as an ovarian cancer survivor myself, I'm one of the lucky few that had early detection, and soon this fall I'll have my 5-year survival. So you're stuck with me for a while, I have to say. But I was one of the fortunate few, and one of the reasons is that the testing for and screening for ovarian cancer is not available, it's not known, and it's not covered by insurance, different from the screening for prostatic cancer, which is and has been covered by insurance since 1996. some insurances cover it, but it's not mandated. And so this bill seeks to mandate the latest that we know scientifically is valid in terms of the kind of screening. It's a limited bill. It says which groups of folks come under the high-risk category and would be covered by the bill. So I'm going to have the rest of the time for you to listen to the people who are experts on this, and we'll start with Dr. Judson.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Patricia Judson. I am in the Department of OBGYN at the University of Minnesota. I'm a gynecologic oncologist, which means that I'm a women's cancer surgeon, and I take care of the women who have ovarian cancer. And I have come today to support this bill. The 1 in 55 women are diagnosed with ovarian cancer, so very few compared to breast cancer, which is 1 in 8. About 75 to 80% of those women are diagnosed at an advanced stage, which means that they have cancer filling their abdomen. These women go through a very extensive surgery. We remove things that are called omental cakes. They're like bunt cakes of cancer from their upper abdomen. These women then need to undergo 6 months of chemotherapy, and 80% of the time their cancer recurs, and they need more chemotherapy in the future. The survival for advanced stage ovarian cancer for 5 years is about 20%. So 80% of these women will die. And the intervening 5 years after that, another 10% of those women will die. The people who survive ovarian cancer are like Representative Clark. They're the people who are diagnosed in stage one. Stage one ovarian cancer has a cure rate of 95% at 5 years. So you can see that obviously we need a good screening test for this cancer. We don't have the perfect screening test yet, but what we do have are the things that are brought up in this bill, which include a physical exam, ultrasounds, and CA125s. Only 50% of the time is a CA125 elevated in patients who have stage one ovarian cancer. However, when this is combined with ultrasound modalities, there's many new modalities out there that are much better than previous. When it's combined, the rate of detection is much higher. There's been big studies done in Europe where they bank their serum, showing that there's a 1.5-year lead time in being able to detect ovarian cancer prior to women having symptoms. The reason for this is that the symptoms of ovarian cancer are very nonspecific. You have bloating, constipation, diarrhea, things that all of us have on and off throughout our lives. And so women don't know that they have ovarian cancer until it's at an advanced stage. I think this is a very good bill. I think it will help improve the survival of women. I think it's very specific in that it looks at only a subdivision of women, women who are at risk of developing ovarian cancer, people with family history, people with a family history of breast cancer or ovarian cancer, which tend to run together, and then people with non-polyposis colorectal cancer, which is another hereditary disorder that tends to run with ovarian and breast cancer. So this bill helps to select women that really need to be screened, and I think it is a very cost-effective bill. And again, I support it.
Thank you so much. We'll now go to, we'll just go right down the way here, Ms. Rain Snyder with the Cancer Survivors Group.
Hello. I would like to put this out. This is my T-shirt, but I'm going to put it out here in honor of Molly Cade. She is the woman who founded MOCA, the Minnesota Ovarian Cancer Alliance, and she testified before this committee 2 years ago in support. It was not passed, but Molly passed. Molly died in December, and she is a huge loss for all of us. And frankly, I wish I wasn't sitting here. I wish Molly was sitting here. Before I briefly tell you my story, I do want to tell you that I am suffering from something called chemo brain. And in case you haven't heard of that, it is a very real phenomenon from going through chemotherapy. And what it does to, what chemotherapy does to your body, it also does to your brain. So if I space out, somebody just tell me I'm chemoed out and I will try to come back too. So I apologize. I realize that that sometimes can make me a little bit disjointed. My name is Rain Snyder. I am a stage 4 ovarian cancer survivor. I was diagnosed 1 year ago today.
I'm happy to be sitting here. One of Dr. Judson's partners ended up saving my life. I'm thankful for. My story started back a few years ago when I was experiencing very severe pain, gastrointestinal problems, diarrhea, very severe diarrhea, bloating, and my regular doctor sent me to a gastroenterologist. He ran me through a huge battery of tests for a long time, and I'm here to tell you it cost a lot of money to send me through all of those tests. He decided that I probably had Crohn's disease, but he wasn't positive. He thought that's what I had, so he was going to treat me as if I had that. So he prescribed steroids, which are not good medicine to be on, but he wanted me to be on those for the rest of my life to control the symptoms of what I had. He also gave me many other medications, all of which made me sicker. I tried to tell him that this wasn't working. He was trying to treat the symptoms, but it was getting worse. I explained to him, as I did to all of the doctors that I came into contact with, that there was that cancer was rampant on my side of the family, my mother's side of the family. And when I was asked, well, do your parents have cancer yet? No. Do your sisters or brothers have cancer? No. Well, then it just really didn't matter. So I was the first one, unfortunately. I also told that gastroenterologist that I had a vivid dream that the word cancer was spelled across my belly. Now, I know this probably sounds a little strange to some people, but it is not uncommon for cancer patients to have that sort of a dream. And I told the doctor, and he said, you don't have cancer. He dismissed that, and there was no further discussion on that because he was the specialist. I went to a world-famous clinic to see if we could come up with some other means of treating me because all of these medications were making me sicker. I went through a huge battery of tests. I was there for 5 days, and it cost a lot of money. And the word I got was that there was no evidence of Crohn's disease. In January of 2002, I was making an appointment with my OBGYN, my regular annual pap smear, and I said I would like to schedule a CA125 blood test because I knew that it was the tumor marker for ovarian cancer. I had no idea that I had all of the symptoms of ovarian cancer. I only knew that the cancer was rampant in my family and that it was a tumor marker. And the receptionist told me, she says, we will be very happy to give you the CA125 blood test. But just so you know, your insurance will not cover it. I said, how much would it cost me? She said, $106. And I said, I can't pay that right now. At the time, it was not in my budget. So I did not take that. Later that year, I went to see a colorectal specialist who told me how important he was. He was world famous, and he said, you're looking at the guy who wrote the book. And I told him about my symptoms, and he said, you don't look like someone who has Crohn's disease. And that was the end of that discussion. February a year ago, I had persistent pain in my lungs, and it kept getting worse and worse, and so I finally went to the doctor. And for the first time, there was some attention paid because it seemed that I had either tuberculosis or lung cancer. So we went through batteries of tests very quickly, obviously, CAT scan blood tests. The CAT scans with the fluid, contrast fluid, showed I did not have lung cancer and the TB tests were negative. However, we did some further testing and it showed that I did have ovarian cancer quite extensively through my body. As I said, I was in stage 4, meaning it had gone to my lungs. For the very first time in my life, I was given the CA125 blood test. A normal rating of that is about 0 to 30. I was 443. I saw an oncologist, and he said, I'm sorry, we can't do surgery. It would be too brutal for you because it's too massive. And besides, with the fluid in your lungs, it would be too dangerous. You can't have that surgery. They said, just to be safe, I want you to see an OBGYN surgeon oncologist. And I did go to see a GYN oncologist. And he began asking me immediately about my symptoms and what testing I'd had. And we went through everything. And he said, didn't anyone ever give you a CAT scan or a transvaginal ultrasound or CA-125? He said, no. I said no to him. And he said, well, I would like to do a surgery anyway, because, and he went through all of his reasons to find out, which made perfect sense to me, and I said, okay, let's go. And I didn't look back. And we went in, and he said, I'm sorry, we can't get it all. I'll do the surgery, but we cannot get it all. And I said, let's go anyway. He said, I want to get as much as we can. We went into the surgery, and he came out. He said it would take 6 hours. He came out 2.5 hours later, and he said, we did get it all. And he said, somebody upstairs is looking out for you. I embarked then on 9 rounds of chemotherapy, and I was treated with Taxol, and I was also in a study, which is testing for various ways to treat ovarian cancer so it doesn't recur, because that's the problem when it's found in late-stage ovarian cancer. So I can tell you that the treatment that I had for ovarian cancer in the first round was very expensive. Platinum isn't cheap, so we weren't saving anybody any money at that point. Along the way, I also had a pulmonary embolism. I will be taking Coumadin for the rest of my life to prevent another blood clot. Also intestinal blockages. Went through all of the chemotherapy, and I'm happy to say that I did briefly go into a remission last fall, only for a couple of months. In my first 3 months checkup, we found out that I'm back in a recurrence. My CA-125 had jumped up to 715. So I am back in chemotherapy, and it is working. We can tell because the fluid in the lungs is going back down again. The CA-125 is going down again. And I'm very grateful to be here. I'm very happy to be here. I'm not angry about what happened to me, but I'm very sad that it happened. And if you pass this bill, it cannot help me. It's too late. But I would like you to think of some other people. I would like you to think of a young woman whose funeral I went to yesterday morning at my church. She was 43, and her grandmother had ovarian cancer, and she had all of the problems that I had, and the doctors essentially ignored her. They told her she had cysts. They finally did go in and have surgery. They found she had stage 3C ovarian cancer. She died. Her funeral was yesterday, and I wish you could see her two little boys who were standing up in front of the casket saying goodbye to her mom, to their mom. I have hope for a future for myself and for others, and part of that hope is that I would like to see earlier detection for other women who are at risk for ovarian cancer and save their lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Next, Representative Clark, who would you like to go next?
I'm Laura Sellers.
Okay, welcome, committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Laura Sellers. I am the president of the Minnesota Ovarian Cancer Alliance, and I am here representing our 1,400 members, among whom are 400 survivors, including myself. I am a 3.5-year survivor of stage 2 ovarian cancer, and I'm 32 years old. I hear stories like Rain's, and it absolutely breaks my heart, which is why we are here to express our support for this bill. In the United States, a woman with no risk factors has a 1.8% chance of developing ovarian cancer. But a woman who has a family history of ovarian, breast, or another related cancer, that chance can be as high as 45%, and she is much more likely to develop ovarian cancer before the age of 50. The number of high-risk women in Minnesota is relatively small, and the cost of the tests are reasonable in comparison to the cost of surgery and chemotherapy. The American Cancer Society also supports the idea that women at high risk could benefit from the screening tests that are specified in this bill. Ovarian cancer is the fifth largest cause of cancer deaths among women, despite the fact that it accounts for only 4% of all cases of cancer in women. And the survival statistics, as Dr. Judson talked about earlier, definitely illustrate this, that in stages 1 and 2, the survival rate is much higher than the drop-off that we see for the 75% of cases that are diagnosed in stages 3 and 4. Late-stage disease is also often accompanied by additional health problems that will require further treatment and, again, incur more cost. And as Dr. Judson also mentioned, even when women in advanced-stage disease achieve remission, they will, in many cases, recur and therefore require additional treatment. The cost of treating ovarian cancer could be greatly reduced by enhancing the likelihood of early diagnosis, and this bill would help do that by ensuring that high-risk women have coverage for the screening tests that can lead to that earlier diagnosis, which means a better chance at long-term survival, less treatment costs, and a reduced chance of recurrence. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Solars. Now we have Catherine Murphy. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Catherine Murphy. I'm a counselor at the Women's Cancer Resource Center, a community-based center in South Minneapolis. We our mission is to serve women with cancer and their families and caregivers, as well as work for prevention of cancer. We are 100% in support of this, whether it's a bill or an amendment, to provide early detection for ovarian cancer for all the reasons that have been very clearly articulated. But let me just reiterate the importance of early detection, which there currently is no coverage for whatsoever. And that's the whole point of this bill, for women who are at risk to have early detection, because with later detection, there is very little hope for survival. We're 100% in support of the bill.
Okay. Representative Clark, is there anyone else you'd like to testify? Okay. And members, just so you kind of know what's going on here, some years ago I had, as chair, entered into agreement with the health committee saying that any mandate bills would go there first, and if they got out of there, come over here. Well, that's why it was my intention to amend this onto the Bradley bill. But what I did instead is I said I wouldn't offer it to the Bradley bill, but I'm also withdrawing the scenario of always going to health first. So now the mandates will go wherever they're sent. So, Mr. Pender, as this bill is redrafted, could you put in the title at about five different places, insurance, 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 so we get it and not health? Just a lot of insurances in there, and we should get it.
Mr. Chair, I can try.
Okay. You're very good at what you do. I know you'll do the right thing. Okay, so that being said, just so members know, because you might be kind of confused that the mandates were supposed to go there first and then over here, we have a long ways to go on this, but I want to get it here and hopefully get it passed out of here and then go to the other committees we need to and work on it with Representative Clark. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Florey and I represent the American Cancer Society. Just wanted to reiterate the comments. We do support this legislation. We believe healthcare mandates should be based on science and evidence, and we believe this bill meets that criteria. Routine cancer screenings are already protected in Minnesota law, but this bill really focuses on a specific high-risk population and geared towards specific tests. We do not believe this is a broad-based mandate that will drive unnecessary care, but rather a science and evidence-based prescription to ensure that women at high risk have a fighting chance to detect and treat their disease.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Clark. Do we have anybody else? Okay, with that, we've got 5 minutes before adjournment. If the members have any questions of any of the folks here, when we actually have the bill up before us, we've had this testimony. Keep this in your head, what you've heard today. And we would, you know, Representative Clark, certainly if some more people want to testify, that would be fine. But there's some folks that will oppose this bill. I'd hate to oppose this bill in this committee. But there are some that want to testify in opposition. And we'll also hear that, of course, and then hopefully get the bill out of here. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair, there are people who have expressed opposition to you?
A couple that have some concern. And members, please don't think that there are no health plans that cover this. There are health plans that cover this. We're just saying there's some that aren't, and we think they should. There are some that already include this in there. Representative Mahoney?
Would that be Representative Bradley's bill? Would that cover this?
Well, actually, 70% of the people, well, that depends on what the Commissioner of Commerce signs off on.
So that's like a no?
That would be, it depends. Because, and Representative Bradley said it very well. 70% of the plans, and I remember when I first started, it was 50-50. Now it's up to 70% of the plans are ERISA, don't even have to have any mandates. And so really we're talking here about 30% of the plans, but I still think that's worth pursuing. Questions?
Right, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Any questions for the folks that are here today? Representative Rukavina.
Sure, maybe for the doctor your cancer had been detected early on, Rainey and Ward, and Representative Clark too, the cost of treating that would be how much cheaper than what you went through for insurance bill
maybe a doctor or someone, you know.
Doctor.
What I'm trying to say, because what he's politely trying to say is that the insurance company is going to pull its detail.
And Representative Rook, I mean, I'm thinking the same way you are on this. I mean, I have to believe.
Why would they? Because it's a lot cheaper.
I have to believe if you catch it stage one, it's going to be a lot cheaper than catching stage five with all the surgeries and the chemos and the radiations or whatever you do with this. Five.
One is.
You're in really bad shape. Okay, four. I'm sorry.
Mr.
Chairman, Representative, the average cost for doing a hysterectomy and staging is not dissimilar to the surgery of a person who would have a stage one. So stage one and stage three, maybe a couple of $1,000 more for a stage three. The chemotherapy cost is really where you get into a lot of the cost. A stage one sometimes cannot undergo any chemotherapy. Generally, they undergo six cycles of chemotherapy over 5 months. Average cost of that may be $200,000 to $300,000. When cancer recurs, these women have chemotherapy for the rest of their lives. So probably those costs are in the $3 million range.
Wow.
I'd like to add that there are two ways that
Ms.
the costs are more. Yes, in the testing, there were tens of thousands of dollars worth of testing that I went through over the course of many different doctors in many different places, only to misdiagnose me because I was never once screened for ovarian cancer. And then the other situation, too, as Dr. Judson mentioned, if you're caught in stage one, you're less likely to recur. The farther along you are, the more certain it is that you will be recurrent for the rest of your life.
Representative Rokovina?
No. Yes.
Representative Pugh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps for Representative Clark, how many of the test fires today would have been in the at-risk population and eligible for the screening under this bill? Were you,
Representative Clark?
No, but you know what? My physician at the Women's Health Center gave me the CA-125 when I had my symptoms, so I was very lucky because it was very high, and they immediately went to try to figure out what was going on. I don't know. I know Rainey well. You mean people who are, we have people in the audience who are from MOCA, Minnesota Brain Cancer Alliance, and maybe can have a show of hands to answer your question because I think that those are the only other people here who are.
But
oh, maybe you can answer that.
Dr. Judson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are 1 in 55 women who develop ovarian cancer, so 2 in 100, basically. About 5 to 10% of those people have a family history that predisposes them. So in this bill, it's probably only 1 in 1,000 women.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh?
Mr. Chair, so Dr. Math wasn't in the high side for me, but so about 1... We're only catching what 1 in 10 would be at risk and eligible for screening. So most of the women that will develop ovarian cancer wouldn't be covered by this screening anyway. Don't we need a broader net for? And I know that'll just bring more opposition from the insurance companies. But shouldn't it be more widely available than the definition in this bill?
Dr. Judson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, there are tests that are being created that are much better, and I hope that in the next couple of years I'll be able to come to you and offer what's called a proteomics test, which tests protein patterns in the blood. It's being tested through the NCI. They have now found that there is an 8 protein pattern in the blood of women who have ovarian cancer. In the 500 people that have been studied, 250 women with ovarian cancer had picked up every single case, including stage one. In the 250 women who did not have ovarian cancer, there were 4 false positives. So 4 women were told they probably had cancer and they didn't. This test is undergoing further testing through the NCI. And hopefully someday, if that test is as accurate as it appears to be, we'll come back here and suggest a broader bill.
Well, Doctor, I don't know if you need to come back here because on page 2, line 7, item 4, it says other proven ovarian cancer screening tests currently being evaluated by the FDA or by the National Cancer Institute. So that should be a kind of a catch-all. With that, we are in recess till 5:30. Members, we will start right at 5:30.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mark, and thank you folks for your testimony today. 5:30, we'll pick up on the mold intrusion bill. And so we are in recess. And we'll start right at 5:30.
That's all he's here at.
Co-author on Wednesday.
It would be.
Your bill? Water metering. Oh, okay.
What do you have, Arlen?
Yes.
What do you have, Arlen?
Mark Bruner came to see you.
That Ellie Gahey banquet.
What's that?
Right up front.
Legislative. Actually, more.
Oh, really?
With the president.
It's a conservative.
Oh, okay. Okay.
We're
quite apart.
That's tonight.
I yeah. Kind
of a oh, I thought you said it was Wednesday.
I know Mark
has well.
I'm here with all my friends.
Yeah, they come in. I said we've had 2 days.
Beam me out of here, would you?
Yeah. Yeah. We've got the room till midnight.
I don't know if you have meat.
I think
Oh, there's yeah. I'll go, wait a second. Did I get kicked off the committee?
No.
Sorry, I got excited
after your stuff. Oh, okay. Good.
What's
that? Good that I could leave.
Yeah,
yeah. Oh. How many amendments are in here today? The same as last time.
Where does this book?
Except the book that's with the original, whatever the original motion was. Three weeks ago.
I wonder if we get more testimony. Huh?
What's that? I didn't hear that today.
It's on tape. Your opponent has a copy. Yep. I don't have the offer. Oh, really? Well, that's good. Right. But it's good to have somebody that doesn't know they're running. You know what I mean? Pretty tough to, well, as you know, figure out what's up together that it's meaningful. Sorry, remark. Traditionally, I'm going to get somebody. The work sneak up to the day free.
Pardon?
Like June.
I'm sorry, I'm not too sure. I've been doing that today.
Oh, yeah. Are.
I'm assuming I'm doing that.
I don't know, they had caucus, you said? I saw Lynn Osterman, she said they just You can kind of answer that. Keep the bill loose. We're going to call the house we were at 5 minutes.
We have
45
seconds.
Yeah, we have 45 seconds.
You're over 25 seconds.
We're going by government. You three.
Oh,
don't have to go in. So we can get in and out of here.
Do you have this? Oh, absolutely. What? For what? Well, I'm going to go for two straight sessions and not saying anything.
Hi, Flora Fenton. How are you?
We haven't even got to those long session times.
Oh.
I started out crabbing this morning. Steak crabbing.
Curtis, what are you doing here? You're like in a fine seat up there, isn't it?
Thursday, regular.
I don't know.
In the real, in the original bill?
Down until when?
Yeah,
original bill. Then you need that amendment that was adopted.
We're going to take our last time for 12:30 on Wednesday. And we got the teacher bill off.
It's like A2 or something.
You're being supported by teacher bill.
We've got a bill tomorrow.
Oh, Thursday.
No.
And then we don't meet again.
It just takes out that new language.
Right.
We're going to bring that to Mexico.
No.
Well, we'll just add to the. It's just tagged on to the team one.
Oh, this is tagged on.
It just. No, it just added some more data.
Who's going to be ready soon? Yeah. Good. I'm going to keep bugging you until it's done. So long as they don't get you.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be nice.
You get those samples.
Listen to my children when I'm talking to them.
It's just a person.
Oh, that's when I have to vote again. Chairman David?
Yes, sir.
Am I going to have to vote against your teacher's bill?
I hope not.
No, it's good, St. Paul.
It does?
Yeah.
Well, I got problems with Minneapolis. And Amsterdam. And Wayzata.
Is this that overall?
And Tony. You don't like that?
Yeah.
You don't call it okay?
Why are you guys?
Jeez.
I'm doing it.
I don't know.
I count you guys as all yeses.
For what?
Especially Mullery.
All those groups that negotiate with
the teacher, statewide teacher bill. At least let me get out of the con.
I'm a co-author. Was that a bad bill? They don't like it? I'm getting just tons of email from my teachers in my district for it, but they're individuals. They were in my teachers. Could be. I'm getting
rain. Tell me which one you're talking about.
Hold on. But I've been at that 24 people in my district. They think that it'll help them more. Right, you've got big numbers.
Are those the amendments we're going to do with the other
day? They're
that passed the very first week.
Oh, I don't know. Give
me a copy of this.
It's a co-author. I don't know. South St. Paul's a really small school district, so they think it helps. I don't know. Didn't the Ed Minnesota back that pilot project from the damn thing? What's the study?
It's from abroad. We need from abroad.
It's not released yet. Okay, I haven't seen it.
Members, while we're waiting for, here's where Representative Broad right there, okay. We will reconvene our meeting at 5:36 on the 24th.
Members, just a quick announcement here from the Heartland Chapter of the American Society of Home Inspectors. You should have a new sheet dated February 24th. Please discard the old one that's not dated. So that this is the most current one for your information. Representative Clancy, please come to the table if you would. So we are working on we'll renew the motion to House File 1801 as amended, be recommended, passed, and sent to the Committee on Civil Law. We'll see what happens if some of these tax amendments goes on. It has to go over to taxes. It's got to go a lot of places regardless here. So which, Mr. Pender, which amendment are we currently working on?
The original.
0892.
Is that the amendment to the amendments? You didn't have it written.
Mr. Chair and members, I think maybe the committee secretary would know that, but I think we were on 892.
Sorry, where did we leave off? Okay. Representative Broad moves an AO. Representative Goodwin moved the AO4-0892 amendment. Representative Broad has an amendment to the amendment to change on lines 18 must to May and lines 19 must to May. Representative Broad?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm withdrawing that
Remember,
amendment.
Mr. Chair, that I asked for a roll call.
Yeah, there's roll calls on everything around here, it seems like.
Yes, there are.
Representative Broad withdraws her amendment. We now have the 0892 amendment. Any more questions from committee members? Otherwise, we will take the roll. Representative Pugh.
Just a quick question. I know Representative Rukavina talked about eliminating lines 18 through 22 on page 2. Did we do that the other day?
I believe that was friendly. Representative Goodwin?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So 18 through 22 on page 2 has been deleted. Okay, the committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Oh, Mr. Chair. Could I speak to the amendment? Mr. Chair, could I speak to the amendment before we vote? I just want to say that I oppose Representative Broad's amendment because it will basically
that's been withdrawn.
Got this amendment. Thank you.
Been withdrawn.
Oh, she did. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, Representative Clancy.
I oppose this amendment that's been proposed by Representative Goodwin simply because it's a redundant law. It is already in law that you can already have those taxes abated by going to your county, and I think it's between the county and the homeowner if that's not happening, and I'd like to keep it that way.
Any further discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Goodwin.
Yes, I'd like to disagree with Representative Clancy because it's now up to the county whether or not they want to do this, and homeowners, some in this audience that have not been able to get their taxes reduced when they've been forced out of their home for a year or 2 years due to mold infestation have not gotten the property tax relief. So I hope you can support this. It's an important part of helping the homeowners who are dealing with this mold issue.
Thank you, Representative Goodwin. Okay, without the committee legislative assistant. Oh, Representative Mullery.
I'm just having a comparison to the other.
Okay, before we vote, we'll let Mr. Pender answer a question. I would like to announce to the committee, especially my good friends on this side of the table here, just so you know, we're working within the Commerce Committee, and if there are folks that believe that the chairman is heartless and ruthless and all those types of things, that's probably true. But on this issue, this is the fourth meeting we've had on this bill. We had scheduled in for one meeting, a full meeting. Normally, we take 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 bills at a time. I do want to announce to the committee so that you can kind of plan your schedules, and if you have bills that we need to get on the agenda, we're going to need them quick from both sides of the table here. March 12th is the first deadline in the House. March 19th is the second deadline, and then the finance deadline is the 26th of March. So that's what we're dealing with. I'm going to try and hear as many bills from both sides of the aisle as we can, but we shut the first thing down on the 12th. We shut the bills from the Senate on the 19th. And then on the 26th, it's the finance bill. So it's unilateral House-only rules. The Senate hasn't agreed to that at this point. So we're on a different course. Representative Pugh and Rukavina and Clark, and some of you that have been around as longer than I have, that's a little different situation we're working under right now. So with that, Representative Mueller, has your question been answered? Did you need to make any comments? Or? Okay. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll on the Goodwin AO4-0892 amendment.
Davids.
No.
Gerlach.
No.
Atkins. Broad?
No.
Clark?
Yes.
Dabney? Dorman? Goodwin?
Yes.
Gunther?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Coles?
No.
Lanning?
No.
Lindner?
No.
Mahoney?
Yes.
Mullery?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
Osterman?
No.
Pugh?
Yes.
Rukavina?
Yes.
Sertich?
Yes.
Simpson?
No.
Stain?
No.
Sikora? Bandevere?
No.
Walls?
No.
Wilkin?
No.
Okay, there being 8 yes, 14 no, the amendment does not prevail. Next amendment, Representative Goodwin offers the, which amendment would you like next?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the 089 to be amendment.
Okay. Members, you should have in your packets the A04-0892B amendment. It's a Goodwin amendment. Please explain your amendment, Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair and members, right now to become a home inspector, all you have to do is call yourself a home inspector, and you can go in and evaluate homes for mold or structural damage or whatever, and you don't have to have any training or experience in that. There are three associations in the state of Minnesota that are home inspection associations that if you're a member of one of those associations, at least you get training and education and so forth. But they are coming up with, they've been working on a licensure bill. They haven't agreed on specific language yet for a licensure bill. However, what happens now is you call a home inspector and you pay $500 to $1,000 to a home inspector who may know nothing about how to find mold or other problems in your home or apartment. And this amendment would just register home inspectors until there's a licensure bill that passes. Many states at least have a process, a licensure process, in order to be called a home inspector. Minnesota does not. This would just say that if they registered, they don't have to register, but if they register and they're part of one of the associations, then the public at least knows who's registered and whether or not they are probably getting an education and so forth. I would like to offer a quick amendment to my amendment because I spoke with the Department of Commerce and the Department of Administration on this, and in the amendment uses the word certification, and we should be using the word registration instead, because there is a difference between certified people and registered people, and this is just a registration process, not a certification process. So if I could just say wherever it says the word certification in here, or certified, we change it to registration or registered.
Okay, Representative Goodwin moves to amend, replacing the word any place where it says certified or certification to go to registered or registration. Any discussion on that? We'll have staff put that together. Mr. Fender, you see what we're doing here?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any discussion? Hearing none, all fair, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails.
No, Mr. Chair, I spoke with Representative Klinsing on this one, as I did with the other parts of this issue here, and she said at that time, at least last week, that she was not opposed to this process. I don't know if she's changed her mind since then, but she was not opposed to registration for this group of people. So I would ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Some good Representative Klinsing comments.
Mr. Chair, actually, one of the organizations did approach me today, the private home inspectors organizations, to talk to me in my office and did raise some of my level of concern. So at this time, I'm not ready to support it, and maybe it'd be good to have them come down and talk about, I mean, tell the whole group what some of their concerns are about this language.
The inspector's concerned about it?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, they also spoke to me about, maybe they spoke to you before they spoke to me, but they spoke to me about 4 o'clock, I believe. And when I told them I was changing the certification to registration, they were okay with this. And that it wasn't a replacement for licensing, which they will eventually agree on.
Representative Goodwin, I think that was the thing that we received, the thing dated 2/24. So what are they saying here? That's old. Sir, if you could briefly tell us if you're supporting the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Roger Hanke. No, sir, we're not supporting the amendment. It's our position that a voluntary program does not provide for suitable consumer protection. We support licensing. We work with you on a rigorous licensing program. Registration, we feel, would be inadequate.
Well, sir, so you want the full certification?
They want the full
license. We want licensure. We do not believe that registration, since it's voluntary, accomplishes anything in the aspect of consumer protection. And we support consumer protection. We want our profession to be well regulated, not regulated by some voluntary program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What organization are you with?
Sir?
Heartland Chapter, American Society of Home Inspectors, and we have a national policy statement on regulation, and this does not conform to it.
Mr. Chair, it was Bedell Ordy I talked to at 4 o'clock, and is he here?
Yes. Come on down. You're the next testifier on the Commerce's.
Yeah, and just one thing before his response to that, I'd like to say that I also support licensure. My comment is they have not, between the three organizations, agreed on a licensure bill. This is not the year that we're going to be able to do licensure with only 3 weeks left in the session for committee deadlines. So what I'm suggesting is that we have voluntary registration until the three groups that represent home inspectors come up with licensure. If we have nothing, we're leaving the homeowners with no protection until you folks come up with a compromise on your licensure.
Representative Mahoney, to that point.
I can wait till the witnesses testify. I have a question
then
for both of them.
More, sir. Okay, if you please state your name and who you represent for the record.
My name is Bredell Oy. I own Oy Home Inspection Incorporated. I'm a certified ASHI member, American Society of Home Inspectors. The voluntary part of this, our concern is that it's going to be less stringent than what we already have. Voluntary, we feel, is worse than not having anything. We would need something where there's something that says that you're responsible for volunteering this. What makes you a home inspector? If you can just volunteer to register for this, there's no guidelines that we can see that qualify you as a home inspector. Again, it relates to, I agree with Representative Goodwin, there's nothing that regulates what a home inspector is. And that's our problem with the way that the amendment stands right now. There's nothing to say what a home inspector is.
Sir, what was your name again?
Bredell Oy.
Bredell, how do you spell your last name?
O-Y-E.
O-I-E.
Yeah. O-Y-E.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just like boy, but leave the B off.
Okay. Mr. Oy. Okay. This, I don't know if this is the way to be getting licensure or certification or registration or whatever we're talking about here. What, are there like three different groups?
The group that Roger and I represent is ASHI, the American Society of Home Inspectors. We're the largest, most nationally known.
Who are the other two groups, sir?
There's an organization called NAHI, the National Association of Home Inspectors, and there's a local group, metro area, MISHI, the Minnesota Society of Home Inspectors. They relate more to city evaluations, Minneapolis Truth in Housing, things like that.
Could your three groups agree on anything? I mean,
we're trying.
Bring something forward that you all three wanted.
We're working.
Somewhat
on
uncomfortable trying to do this right now, Representative Mahoney.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I've been involved in a couple of these organizations trying to come together on a licensure or some agreement. Somebody asked this question: how long have you been trying? Is this the first year, or is this the 10th year?
First year, less than a year. Months.
Roy?
Several months, perhaps. 3 months.
Representative Mahoney?
And Representative Goodwin went over the fact that you're not going to get anything this year. But I did want to bring to the committee's attention on page 1, line 8, completed any educational requirements as required by the commissioner. Starting and continuing on.
8 and 9.
Experience required by commissioner. Number line 12, passed any written or electronic examination offered or approved by the commissioner. You know, the commissioner is going to put it all together. If this isn't good enough, you might not even get this next year. You may be on your own for a while. Well, just be careful what you wish for around here.
Representative Goodwin, are you aware, is there a fiscal note on this for Commerce? They have to hire so many more people to run this, or are you aware of anything like that?
No, I'm not aware.
Representative Rukavina, to that point?
Yes, the Commerce, the people from Commerce.
Is anybody from Commerce here that could maybe answer that?
Does anybody work
in
Commerce?
Well, there were a bunch of cuts last year. I forgot to tell you, we cut
they
Commerce.
Here,
actually,
they were here for a major bill today. They're not here tonight. Maybe we can get rid of the whole agency.
I'm going to start it.
Mr.
Okay, I got to get this thing back.
Mr. Chair.
I'm not sure just where I am. Let's go back for a second. Go
Mr. Chair, I just do want to tell you that we've had several meetings. This is not coming out of the blue on my part. We had several meetings over the last 6 to 8 months on this issue. One that Mr. Oy was at, and one that a representative of NAHI was at, one of the other home inspection groups. I've talked to several home inspectors. They're in a huge turmoil over what kind of a bill they want for, and they evidently don't like each other much or have some personal issues going on. But the bottom line is, I don't care what they do on licensure. The homeowners have to have some way of knowing that when they're paying $500 or $1,000, and by the way, there isn't anything right now, nothing. So any one of us could call ourselves a home inspector. And they only have to be insured, or they only have to pay for if they're wrong. Say you spend your $1,000 to get them out there to check your house, and they're totally wrong about what they give you. You can only get your money back. You cannot sue them for being wrong and buying $1 million home or a $500,000 home that's full of problems. You can't sue them for that. And there's nothing in here that would let you sue them for that. But at least we're saying they have to have some education, and the commissioner can make those determinations, and the homeowners can have some protection.
Let me just throw this out. We've got a lot of people who want to talk about this. If, and I don't know if this is a good idea or not, I haven't thought it through, if we were to have an actual hearing on this as a bill, because I can see where, you know, with this kind of new industry of home inspection, or maybe it's not that new.
Not new.
Maybe we need to actually have a bill on something like this and have the hearing. And because I'm quite uncomfortable with a couple people representing a couple groups and trying to throw this together and put a Band-Aid on something that should be thought through a little bit here.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Klinzing.
Thanks. That's why this wasn't in the initial bill and continues to not be added to my bill, because I'm currently still in discussions and trying to work these things through, and wasn't comfortable that we had all the stakeholders talking and feeling right about a piece of legislation. And it's something that's on my docket of further things that need to be discussed, brought up, put into legislation, but it just didn't feel ready at this time. That's why I'm not ready to accept it as an amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Goodwin.
That means that if nothing is done on this year, there will be hundreds of more homes inspected around the state by people who may or may not know what they're doing. And more people will end up out of their homes for reasons of either structural damage or mold or other problems. And we're going to wait a whole other year to give homeowners any kind of protection. I would say this is very harmless stuff. At least the consumers can have a list of people who they know are registered with the department who have had some kind of education and training on this. It certainly is a step in the right direction, and I don't think that going another year without it is going to do anybody any good.
Representative Goodwin, that may very well be, but if we have an amendment that hasn't had much testimony or debate and none of the groups like, I don't know if that's the way to do it either.
Representative Mahoney, to that point, you have the floor, and then we're going to Rukavina and Clark. Representative Mahoney.
You know, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess this is a question for you know, the lawyers on this side get asked all the time, so there's got to be a lawyer over on that side. You know, or maybe I guess I'll have to go to staff, but tell me, you know, if you're in court, and there's a home inspector and there's no registration or certification or anything like that, and you're in court and you ask the question, is this a valid expert witness to say that there's mold in the place? I unless we do something. Unfortunately, I think Representative Klinzing's bill is kind of like toothless.
Sir, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there seems to be some misunderstanding about the effect of a registration program and even more misunderstanding about what we do in our profession. First of all, the registration program, as I see it from what I can read about it, is voluntary and does not regulate all those parties practicing in the profession. It only regulates those who choose to register. Secondly, a home inspection, even done correctly, is not going to always or completely solve or identify a mold problem in a house. We're very good, but there are situations where that doesn't happen. So I think your faith or the committee's faith of the author in this legislation is perhaps misplaced, in that we're the answer to the mold problem. We're a partial answer, and worse, that this registration is the answer to some perceived problem with home inspectors. I don't see it being the answer.
Let me ask you this, sir. If we pulled this back, well, I can't pull it back in terms of some good ones, man, but if it was pulled back and we actually set up a date to have an actual hearing on it, would you be able to come to some consensus on what you wanted to do for for licensing or registration?
I think that the position paper our national organization has and that the other national organization has are very similar, and we've tried to work together. I think with the pressure of this short session, perhaps we can work together better. Come up with what you need.
Okay, Representative Mahoney, you still have the floor. Are you?
Oh, I'm willing to give it up, sir.
Representative Rukavina, then Clark. Then we're going to vote on this, unless somebody else wants to talk.
To the amendment, I think Representative Goodwin raises some good points, and there's got to be something in this bill that actually does something to help these people that have testified over the last three meetings or whatever it is, Mr. Chair. And as far as a fiscal note and your question on what kind of cost, there's a whole bill here full of, the commissioner doing certain things, which is going to cost money, which I asked initially and nobody seemed to care. So I don't think that fiscal responsibility has been exhibited.
Yeah. Okay. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I just testified to the good job is because inspected my house and they're very good. So, as a friend, I want to say I tried to take this registration. And the reason I do is that it doesn't put the pressure on you. It doesn't harm you at all. All it does is say there's going to be a voluntary list that if a consumer wants to call up and find out which agencies had cared enough to have their names on the state register, which means they're probably more likely to
it
helps the consumer, and it doesn't harm
them.
And it seems to me that helps get
this one
folks to the table. So I think
just
it's not going to happen.
Turn around, tell Denise
the conference is here. For myself, okay. This is a huge issue at my community. People said it's must license inspector. You have to do this. So what I want to tell you is, we've been here a while, I know that to get to step 1, 2, 3, I never heard Representative Goodwin say that this solves the problems at all. She's not holding that out. She's saying this helps you get the first baby steps,
no one have a physical motor.
So that's what I really think it's helpful, it's harmless. and it's helpful to pursue it, that there be a registered income in all kinds of professions. If you can't get a license right away, you start, I think of, you know, other same one that I was up to, you start out with a registration. People who dare put their name up and say, you know, you can bring it into the light. And then you go to a more, you know, interactive or regulatory or this is a helpful way to see if this is safe to work with other.
Sure.
Well, thank you, Representative Clark, and I appreciate your kind words. The experience of our national organization has been to the contrary, unfortunately, that registration programs do not lead effectively to licensure, and that, in fact, it leads to difficulties getting licensure. So we're very concerned that this half a loaf may in fact not even be half a loaf. It may be minus half a loaf. So we're very concerned about that. And finally, the things that this bill proposes to do are currently already available in the private sector. Both of our professional societies have websites, have information for the consumer about what our qualifications are, what our requirements are. So the information is already available.
Okay, Representative Goodwin moves the A04-0892B amendment as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Mr.
Opposed?
Chair, I asked for a roll call vote the other day. I said I wanted a roll call vote on all my amendments.
Oh, she did. Okay.
I did.
That. Yes, you did. She did.
The clerk will take the roll.
Yeah, she informed me that she won roll call.
Yes, I did.
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Davids?
No.
Gerlach?
No.
Atkins? Broad?
Yes.
Clark?
Yes.
Dabney? Dorman? Goodwin?
Yes.
Gunther?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Coles?
No.
Lanning?
No.
Lindner? Mahoney?
Yes.
Mullery?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
Osterman?
No.
Pugh?
Yes.
Rukavina?
Yes.
Sertich?
Yes.
Simpson?
No.
Stang?
No.
Socorro? Vandeveer? Walls?
No.
Wilkin?
No.
Mm-hmm. There being 9 yes and 12 no, the motion does not prevail. Item next, we have the A04. This is the final amendment, and then we're going to vote on the bill. Goodwin moves the A04-0892A amendment. There will be a roll call. Representative Goodwin, please explain your bill. Or your amendment, I'm sorry.
Whose amendment is this? Yours?
This is the 0892A amendment, the last one.
Mr. Chair and members, this has a number of provisions in it that are protections to help homeowners with construction issues, whether they be mold or other issues related or unrelated to that, but for home repairs and home remodeling and building. You heard from Nancy Johnson, constituent in my district who had her roof replaced and ended up with mold, extensive mold throughout her house, $350,000 worth of damage on a $200,000 home. You've heard from other people who have been taken by either contractors or subcontractors in different areas. I'm not here to say that all folks that do this kind of work are not I'm trying to shift the public because that's absolutely not true. But this will give some protections to the public. What it does is requires written estimates for repairs and remodeling. That's a simple thing. And the contractor can charge for the estimates. But if the repair is going to be more than 10% over what the estimate is, then they have to do a new estimate without charge to let the homeowner know that. The invoices at the end of the project have to be more detailed and to include any warranty information on the work that they've done. The homeowner has the right to a civil suit or legal action, and instead of being forced into arbitration. It prohibits subcontractors from filing a lien against a homeowner when the homeowner has paid the contractor in full and the subcontractor has not paid, that it has not been paid by the contractor. That's, I actually have articles that I'd like to send out about this. There have been two people convicted recently of doing this, and unfortunately they're only convicted if they do it to a whole lot of homeowners and the county attorney finally gets a hold of it. But what's happening out there is that some contractors are purposely not paying their subcontractors, especially sometimes it's the lumber yard. And then the materials aren't paid for or whatever, and then the subcontractor comes after the contractor. If the homeowner has already paid in full, then they'll have to pay twice. In order to get the lien off their home, they'll have to pay twice. So that's that issue, and I hope that you support it. There's other... A couple other issues in here on the written estimates. That's it's pretty clear language, and at this point, I would just ask for your support. I also want to point out to you this article that we've sent around from Tamarack. That is a company that does mold and mildew, and there's a lot of good information in here. We worked with this company when putting together our legislation during this past summer and fall. And they're very, very knowledgeable about mold problems and the causes and so forth. And I would have liked this expert to speak tonight, but we have not been allowed to give more public testimony. Unfortunately, he couldn't make it the other meetings. But he is here tonight in case we have any questions for him. And in the meantime, I'd just like you to look at the information that he passed out. I'd also like you to look at some of these pictures that I'm passing out. I've got some more constituents here who called just the other day and didn't even know there was this mold legislation and asked me to have put out some mold legislation. They live in apartments, Springbrook Apartments in Fridley, where I represent. And Nancy and Sheila and their spouses are here tonight. Nancy, they live in apartments that are full of mold. Nancy has sores all over her body, and her husband has developed asthma and also spots on his lungs and other organs. Nancy has spots on her kidney. Sheila and her husband moved out of the building that and into another Springbrook building that also has mold in it. Sheila is a mold remediator and lives in moldy buildings herself. This is a huge problem, and I just think we really need to be serious about it. We've spent a lot of committee meetings on this, but it's well worth it. And I know I've spoken to, in the last few weeks, I've spoken to people from Representative Osterman's district who have called me on this issue, Representative Wilkins' district, Representative Johnson's district. There's a lot of homes in Plymouth with mold in them. Most of the people on the other side of Representative Broad's district, you've got people with moldy homes, and you can decide if you're going to cater to the Builders Association or in the insurance industry, or if you're going to help the people in your districts, because this is a serious, severe health problem. And right now, Minnesota is not doing anything about it. So Representative Clemson's bill makes a start, but I would say that there's a lot more than that that needs to be done, and I would like to see homeowners protected in some way here. So my amendment attempts to do that, and I would appreciate your support.
Okay, thanks for something.
Okay. Representative Goodwin moves the AO4-0892A amendment. The committee
A roll call, please.
Committee Legislative Assistant.
David?
No.
Gerlach?
No.
Yeah. Atkins? Broad?
No.
Clark?
Yes.
Dabney? Dorman? Goodwin?
Yes.
Gunther? Johnson?
No.
Coles?
No.
Lanning?
No.
Lindner? Mahoney?
No.
Mullery?
No.
Nelson?
No.
Osterman?
No.
Pugh?
Yes.
Rukavina?
Yes.
Sertich?
Yes.
Simpson?
No.
Stain?
No.
Sikora? Vanderveer?
No.
Walls?
No.
Wilkin?
No.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there being 5 ayes and 15 nays, the amendment does not prevail. We hear Representative Nelson.
I'd like to make a small amendment to the A2A amendment, or to delete the line on page 1, delete line 23 and 24, and on line 2, 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Okay, time out here. What?
Basically, what that does is put back the language from the original bill for the attorney's fees.
We didn't take them out.
She modified them, Mr. Chair.
Oh, where's the A2 amendment?
That's what we're working on. That's what we're working on.
I've got the bill here. Where's the...
Mr. Chair, the original amendment that
Craig believed
that Benson offered the first day we heard the bill.
Okay, here it is. Okay, so this is amended into 1801. And so now we're going back to the original A2 amendment. Yeah. And can you please repeat your amendment, Representative Nelson?
On the A2A amendment, A2 amendment here, to delete
which
page
8?
1, delete line 23 and 24.
You delete 22 also?
No, just 23 and 24.
On page 1, anything on page 2?
And page 2, delete lines 1, 2, 3, and 4. And basically what that does is put back in the language from the original bill about going for the limited attorney's fees. It puts some teeth in it. Otherwise, if they sue, if they're back to where they were before, that puts some teeth back in the amendment.
Okay, so members, we're on the 1801. We're on House File 1801 as it currently stands, which is as amended, which Representative Nelson is moving to delete on page 1, lines 23 and 24, and on page 2, lines 1 through 4. Any discussion for members on that?
It's like a roll call now on that also.
Okay, roll call has been asked for.
Where, yeah.
We don't have okay, time out. We don't. We may need some more copies of this.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Rukavina,
we obviously saved ours because we were concerned about the consumers, but basically, I don't think that what you're doing is just being saving money that Representative Pinsett eliminated that would not allow people to recover the attorney's fees, which I think we heard the first day of testimony.
No,
was
she didn't accept
Mr. Chair.
I withdrew that amendment.
No,
it's different. Representative Rukavina, go ahead. Let Representative Rukavina finish.
Sure. I thought that he had put the sheet back in that was pulled out that he got on the first day.
Representative Rukavina, what we did was this amendment was accepted as the language the author wanted. Representative Osterman had an amendment to pull the attorney fee issue out. That was withdrawn. Representative Mullery helps out here.
Mr. Chairman, basically, I hate to agree with Representative Rukavina, but he really is right. There was the original language of the bill with attorney's fees, and I can't remember where it is. That's page 7, I believe.
Page 7, yeah.
Which is pretty standard language. Then Representative Osterman had an amendment, but she withdrew that to take out the language with attorney's fees. then Representative Klensing put in this A2 amendment as an author's amendment, which in essence does almost the same thing as taking out the attorney's fees. So it basically is taking out the attorney's
members,
fees.
This is what we're going to do. We've sent the page to make some more copies so that everybody, I want everybody to have this in front of them before we vote on it. So are there any other amendments that we're going to have? Or is this the, this it as far as we know?
No.
Okay. Well, we'll just wait a second here. We can certainly debate it now. Well, we can't because we have it. Representative Klensing. Okay, Representative Klensing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that some of the representatives are saying that the new language does nothing, and that was news to me in the testimony. Some of the legal expertise that I talked to, this actually raises this, not raises a standard, but this increased the rights that homeowners had in court compared to what they've got now. The language that was proposed here in the A2 amendment. So to say that it does nothing really is an inaccurate statement, and it's a battle between legal minds who think differently depending on where you fall in the spectrum. But it definitely, the new A2 language does do more for the homeowner now than anything currently in statute. So I do want to make sure that everyone's aware of that, that it does help the homeowner more than what they're at right now.
Okay, Representative, we'll take some questions on the bill as it is now, but we will come back to the Nelson Amendment when everybody has copies. Representative Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As long as we're waiting, I don't know that, I don't think I missed this in the testimony, or maybe we covered it. There was a lot of discussion, news stories about stucco, and if that's the problem, or if this bubble of homes in the 90s, the problem is just limited to stucco, or if it's all houses or what. And I can't remember if you covered that initially. That's been so long ago. But I'm wondering, do you or the builders or somebody from, you know, because Woodbury is where a lot of this came from, is somebody, can someone tell me the scope of the problem, stucco versus regular construction or other construction, I should say, and you know what I'm asking? What the ratio is?
Right.
Is stucco the problem?
Stucco is not entirely the problem. They found about 25% of the incidences in Woodbury are stucco related, which made stucco a siding that had a higher incidence, but certainly was not the majority of cases.
Representative Gerlach.
Okay. All right. So you say 25% of the incidents in Woodbury was stucco. All right. That's what I want to know. Thank you.
Representative
Simpson.
Now that we're into the year 2003 construction, 2004 construction, with the new practices that are being done today, have we eliminated this problem?
Representative
Klensing. From reports I've been getting from homeowners who had homes built a couple years ago, they're still discovering high levels of moisture in their homes that are causing problems. So. It is, I don't think that some of the new things that have been changed about the building codes have entirely addressed all the problems. It's a complex issue, and we're just touching the surface with some of this legislation. We'll continue to do so with this some more.
Any other questions for the author?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Me.
Representative Johnson.
This isn't necessarily a question, but as we're waiting for this language to come back, I think there's maybe been some confusion about what happened with the A2 amendment, because there is still a provision for attorney's fees for plaintiffs to recover in this bill. Representative Klensing's amendment added some language to that, which apparently some people don't like, to argue that it does nothing or that the attorney's fees provision is no longer in there, which some of my constituents have called to say they have been told is quite false. And I hope everyone recognizes that and takes a look at this, because this, it's if you're looking at the bill, it's page 7, line 11. That underlined new language is all still there. It's just, you
so
see that?
She adds.
And then to that is added, and the vendor refused to perform the vendor's obligation under the warranty without a good faith basis for the refusal. There is an attorney's fee provision in here, which is not currently in law. It's a very significant new benefit for homeowners in a case like this. I know it's not as good as some people want, but it, to say it's gone is false.
Representative Mallory?
Mr. Chairman, it is, there is an attorney's fee clause, but for practical purposes, it is certainly not significant.
I disagree.
It is almost never going to be used because there is anybody that's on the other side, unless they totally stonewall, they know what's the real way out, and they will play games and get around in a second.
Okay, Representative
Rubina,
and then Pugh.
Well, I just wanted to say that Representative Johnson is a perfect attorney. Maybe you could tell us lay people here, and for the homeowners that have come and been concerned about themselves, what the amendment did to dilute the language on pages 11, 12, and lines 11, 12, and 13.
Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rutavina, what it did was in order for a plaintiff to recover attorney's fees, they must show that the vendor refused to perform their obligations under the warranty without a good faith belief. I mean, it does exactly what it says. And I disagree with you that it's almost worthless. I think there's certainly many instances where this will be used and probably used quite effectively by attorneys, whether they're corporate attorneys or otherwise.
Yes. Representative Rukavina.
Representative Johnson, I see here the vending must be awarded if the prevailing party. But then the language adds some other, the amendment offered by Representative Whitley adds some other language in there that dilutes this.
It,
Representative Johnson?
Right. As I just explained, it adds an additional obligation on the part of a plaintiff to recover attorney's fees. Yes.
Representative Rukavina?
Well, no, Mr. Chair, and then if you agree, Representative Johnson, that it then weakens the ability to collect attorney's fees.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson?
It makes it harder, yes.
Mr. Chair.
But it's absolutely still there.
Representative Klinzing?
It does not weaken it from where it is right now. It is stronger language than what homeowners currently have.
Well, it weakens it from what's in the original
Chair,
bill.
Representative Klinzing, you know, I know that. You know, I saw a couple of years ago when Representative Anderson had a workers' comp bill where people die and wanted to have some money go to the family, and he, you know, did the same thing you did. He diluted his own bill and then said, well, it's better than current law. But I don't think it helps, you know, with the problem that we've been trying to address here and where we're meeting, you know, already 3 weeks in the session or whatever it is. And, at 5:30 at night, because of your bill, we've seen a lot of heartache in that here in the audience. And I still say, even if the Nelson Amendment goes on, that we really haven't accomplished a lot at all by this. We still have insurance companies that sell insurance to builders, that builders that are required to buy insurance to build a home in Minnesota, that they just take them to court. And you heard Mr. Johnson, Olson Johnson. talk about how you got to show neglect or whatever, and they're going to keep suing it out. And at least, you know, if we reinstate the language as Representative Nelson is proposing, perhaps the insurance industry will feel that they don't want to delay as long as they keep delaying. And Mr. Chair, members, quite frankly, I wish there were a lot more teeth in the bill, because this is a problem that we're going to keep seeing around here in Minnesota. And, you know, I'm not blaming anyone at all, but I don't think this bill is solving the problem. The bottom line is these people that took time off and came here three or four times now to listen to us, what did they get out of it? And maybe Representative Benson can tell me what they're going to get out of it, because I really don't see, even with the Nelson language, how we're that much farther down the road to getting repaid for getting buying a home that is in terrible, terrible condition. Now, we heard the threat the other day, Mr. Chair, and maybe we, as this bill moves along, which I'm sure it's got to go to other places, We heard the threat from the insurance industry that they're not going to sell insurance of this type in Minnesota anymore. So maybe we should start a state insurance. Maybe we should have a small percentage on every homeowner's insurance policy in the state of Minnesota and put it in and have a WICRA type, workers' comp reinsurance, where we made a quasi-state agency that, incidentally, and you're an insurance agent, Mr. Chair, gave back every single dollar of premium they've collected in the state since they were formed over 20 years ago to their policyholders because they overcollect there. They thought they were insuring the most sick people in the state, injured people on the job, gave back all the money. Maybe that's what a state-run insurance company can do, is if their investments are coming in off the stock market, and maybe we should do that to help these people, because it's obvious the insurance companies aren't going to help, and I don't think they're going to help. That's my take on it. So
okay.
At least put some teeth into it for your own member and vote for the Nelson.
What we're going to do is we have Pugh and Goodwin, but we're going to go back, and you're on the list for the bill, but we're going to go back to the amendment right now, the Nelson Amendment. Our members have had a little time to look it over, so we'll go back to discuss the amendment. Again, what that amendment is, for the record, is on page 1, delete lines 23 and 24. Page 2, delete lines 1 through 4. Any further discussion on the Nelson Amendment? Representative Pugh.
Mr. Chair, that had intended to talk on that amendment. Everybody that spoke on the amendment is a little bit right. Current law, under current law, most claimants probably couldn't recover attorney's fees. They'd have to demonstrate that the litigation, the defendant in the litigation was acting in bad faith. That's a tough standard. The original bill, 1801, said that a homeowner, if they prevail, if they win the case, they get their attorney's fees. And that, I think, was a real plus for the homeowner. Because what happens in these cases, and we heard the testimony from a number of homeowners and one attorney who was not only an attorney in this type of case, but also had a home that had this kind of problem. If you have $150,000 in damages, needed repairs, and you've got $30,000 in trying to collect that, you're only going to have $120,000 left to fix the house. You lose. There's no incentive to even going forward. The original bill gave your attorney's fees back. It made you whole. You're in good shape at the end. You're in the same spot you started in. This amendment actually causes litigation over the fees. You've got to prove that the builder didn't act in good faith in trying to fix it. Even if the builder's insurer might not be coming forward with payment, the builder might be acting in good faith. And they're back in the same place they were under current law. So I think if you want to do something for the homeowners, the people that have this problem, you have to vote for the Nelson Amendment. I mean, we see it differently, Mr. Representative Johnson and I. To do something positive for homeowners, we need to have the original attorney's fees language in there. It's what every witness that testified about their problems wanted. It's what the attorney that Representative Klinzing called to testify on behalf of the bill. It's what she wanted for her personal life and for her clients. It's really the only way to make a level playing field for homeowners and for builders in this case.
Thank you, Representative Pugh. Representative Mullery, to the amendment, the Nelson Amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Pugh did a good job, although I think that it's actually, I think that the more I look at this, there is nothing in here left, because basically you can already get it for bad faith. So here you're saying you can get them if there's no good faith. Well, bad faith versus no good faith, that sounds an awful lot the same to me. And so basically what you're doing is putting in the same law in effect, that what's already there.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments on the Representative Nelson's amendment? If not, the committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Davids?
No.
Gerlach?
No.
Atkins? Broad?
No.
Clark?
Yes.
Dabney? Dorman, Goodwin?
Yes.
Gunther? Johnson?
No.
Coles?
No.
Lanning?
No.
Lindner? Mahoney?
Yes.
Mullery?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
Osterman?
No.
Pugh?
Yes.
Rukavina?
Yes.
Sertich?
Yes.
Simpson?
No.
Stang?
No.
Sikora? Vandeveer?
No.
Walls?
No.
Wilkin?
No.
while we're telling, just remember members and folks in the audience, this is the first of many stops for this bill. So if you have concerns, please call the author, work with the author, or other members to try and get amendments that are on civil law committees or whatever other committees it has to go to. There are 8 yes, 12 no. The motion does not prevail. Now the bill is before us, Representative Pugh.
My comments for today.
Okay. Representative Goodwin has the floor.
Mr. Chair, the question has come up several times here about whether or not the problem is solved, per se. The problem isn't only, Representative Adelson, with new homes and new builders. It's, in the case of my constituent, somebody that put a roof on her house and didn't vent it and ended up being $350,000 worth of damage. It's going to be with us for a long time. It's in the Springbrook apartments that are at least 15, 20 years old, and the entire building is full of mold and damaging people that live there. We've got to do something more about it than what we're doing here. This is a start. I'm not going to say it's nothing. It is a start. I think we could have done some serious work on this issue this year for all the time we've spent on it. I don't think we did that. I don't think we've helped people enough. But I did want to say that since that question came up, Paul Elringer is here, who is an environmentalist, home inspector. I don't even want to say his title but I would like to, at least before we vote on this bill, I would just like to hear from him about whether or not this problem is solved, if that would be okay.
Representative Goodwin, I'm not going to allow that because I told a lot of people not to testify. I can't pick one out and say one can do it. So go ahead, you have the floor. That wouldn't be right to everybody else that said they want to testify to pick one out here.
Okay, with that, I have nothing more to say.
Representative Sertich?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've been in and out of the 4 days here, and I'm sure some of the audience members haven't been here the whole time. So, Representative Kensington, can you just tell us now, as amended, what your bill does?
Mm-hmm. Representative Kensington?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Sertich. What it does do is it starts to work on some of the proactive things that need to happen about building in the future. And the first thing it does is it sets up pre-licensure for builders. That currently there is no pre-licensure.
Excuse me just a second. I'm going to interrupt here. Representative Goodwin, was the gentleman that you want to testify the one that handed out this handout?
Eric Tamarack.
And I'm not even going to apologize for it. It's 4 days on what should have been a one-day meeting. Everybody that I said, we're done with the testimony, we're going to work on the amendments and work on this bill. Anybody that has wanted to, our answer has been, if you want something to submit to the committee, do it in writing, and we'll have that, and we have this for the record. So we do have the gentleman's, Mr. Paul Elringer, PECIH, Registered Professional Engineer, Certified. Have you heard anything about go to school? Wow, that's impressive. Okay, so it is on the record here, Mr. Elringer's testimony. Excuse me, Sertich has the floor, if you could tell us what the bill does.
Yes. It does require, for the first time, pre-licensure continuing education courses for builders seeking licensure, and those will be dedicated, not exclusively, but in the bill, some of that will be dedicated to the building codes. For those builders who already have licensure, there is language in there to require them to take some of that licensure as continuing education about the state building codes and the other building codes that are out there that they have to abide by. And currently that, that's what's in the bill, but right now there is no directive as to what the building codes, builders need to learn in that continuing education. So they may get the continuing education and never learn about the building codes. And the next piece, and obviously those two things are not going to help people who are in the situation right now, but a lot of homeowners I've spoken to were understanding that sometimes we cannot pass retroactive legislation, but they did want to inform me of their story so that we could try to get to the root of this and solve it for future homeowners. Another thing that changes is oftentimes some of the homeowners would come to these meetings and talk about how the private inspector never caught this or never caught that or didn't catch this problem. And there was, as I looked deeper into it, there was somewhat of a misunderstanding on the homeowner's part as to what an inspector looks at and does not look at. granted, there were inspectors that didn't always catch things that needed to be caught. That, I think, needs to be addressed with some of the certification, registration, or licensure legislation that will be coming down the pike as we can get deeper into that issue. But at least with this, what we could provide for homeowners was a state website that does tell them what makes a good private home inspector, what they do inspect and what they don't inspect, and links to some of the private home inspection, ASHI, NAHI, MISHI, those websites, so that people can get in contact with private home inspectors who are linked to an organization and use the state's website to evaluate whether that those inspectors are going to work for them, to try to clear that up. The other thing is homeowners, this homeowner's guide that that is in the legislation that the Commissioner of Commerce is going to put together is going to provide homeowners with delineation of, again, what gets inspected, what doesn't get inspected, what they need to look for along the timeline, much like your 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 mile check on your car might do. And so that's also in the legislation. I think the bigger meat to this piece of legislation, or the proposed legislation that does deal with homeowners currently going through this problem, is the part that requires the builder to meet with the homeowner within a certain number of days. Because right now I'm talking to homeowners who have tried to call their builder, get them on the phone, get them to meet, get them to come in and look at their house, and they're 2 years down the road looking for a lawyer to help them get the builder to come. This legislation says, no, that has to happen within a couple of months of the within a month of the request. And it sets up that timeline, and if it doesn't happen, a couple things. One, that can be used in court against a builder. Secondly, the license can be suspended, which is very strong language for those builders. Currently, you can't suspend their license for not meeting with the homeowner who has a problem. So that's something that I think will help. Some of the homeowners just said they don't really want to go to court. They just want their house fixed. And hopefully this will help some of those. It's not going to end court cases altogether. I'm aware of that. But I think it also gives the homeowners one more tool to take with them if they should have to end up in court with this. The last thing was the attorney's fees piece, which you heard debated. I believed it had enough teeth to be much better than what homeowners have right now. But there are some legal, experts even within this own room who disagree. But it definitely does a little more than what homeowners have currently for recouping the legal fees that they need to incur in order to take this to court.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How confident are you if this legislation is passed as is that we will not be hearing any more stories like people that are sitting in this room?
Mr. Quincy?
One thing that this legislation has done, I'll answer it directly and then I'll answer it indirectly. I'm confident that we will see a reduction in some of the suits that are currently taking place. I'm confident that we will see a reduction in some of the homes being built the way they're being built. I'm not confident that it will solve all the problems. One of the most valuable parts to this, and why I'm so, I have a lot of gratitude for this committee for giving it 4 days of hearings. I know that's unusual for bills. This is a very complicated problem, and as I've started to, it's like peeling off layers of an onion. There's problem after problem after problem, and I've got a list of things that need to be done legislatively if we're going to really solve 95% of these problems. And this legislation has started to bring a lot of people to the table who weren't talking before. It's given us a chance to have a public debate about what's going on and bring some of these problems to the fore. So I'm confident that it's a very good start.
Representative Sturdivant?
Just one more question, Mr. Chair. I know we heard at the beginning 4 days ago or 4 meetings ago, the Commerce Commissioner was sitting in that chair and said that he liked certain portions of the bill and didn't support certain portions of the bill. I can't vote yes on certain portions of the bill and no on other portions of the bill. I'm wondering with the changes made, and I'll just throw this out there again because maybe somebody from Commerce has showed up at the meeting now. Do we know if Commerce is supportive of the bill, not supportive of the bill, or that kind of wishy-washy in-between thing that doesn't help us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sturdivant, I think that I've learned that it's probably through the process of being a legislator, it's probably a good bill if people don't agree on every aspect of it. You've heard the insurance industry doesn't like every aspect of it. The builders don't like every aspect of it. Homeowners don't. There's aspects of it they don't like, yet there's aspects of it they do like. Every stakeholder, there's aspects of it they like and aspects of it they don't like. And that's because we're trying to come to a compromise of something that is going to work for everybody. There's something in here to try to help everybody out.
Well, I don't care as much if the Commerce Department likes it or not. They're the ones that have to enforce this.
Representative Sturdivant, I think we do have someone from the Department of Commerce here now. Mr. Sexton, if you could come down. The question is, as you're coming down, as...
to the sacrifice.
We're going to wait
sure he's going to come back in that question.
We're not opening up the whole can of worms. Mr. Sexton, why are you here? No, I didn't say that.
Remember,
Sexton from the Department of Commerce. The question from Representative Sturdivant is, as the bill is amended before us now, does the Commerce Department support it, oppose it, or are they enthusiastically neutral?
Pat Sexton from the Department of Commerce. We've been working with Representative Klinzing since the outset, the commissioner in the department, and we are supportive of what she's trying to get done.
Are you supportive of the bill as amended?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Sturdivant, you have the floor.
Thank you, and Mr. Sexton, thanks for coming down. Do you feel comfortable that you can uphold all the responsibilities, that new responsibilities given to you under this legislation?
Mr. Sexton?
Representative Sturdivant, Mr. Chair, yes.
Representative Sturdivant? Thank you. Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Klinzing. I've read this bill. I've tried to follow the amendments as they kind of wound their way around and had to go get recopied and had to dig through which ones. And we get pre-licensing education, post-licensing education, a website that tells you where you can get an inspection, where you can get an inspector, a manual from the Commerce Department, and a very high standard you have to jump over to get attorney fees back. And a meeting after 45 days or 60. We spent 11 hours on this particular bill, and we get a 45-day meeting. I think that's the way I read this bill. Welcome to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Any other questions from members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vandiver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Klinzing, I think you've done a really good job with this bill. And I think as we look at it, that it goes a long way at least towards developing a problem-solving process, one that brings people together and assigns some more accountability than was there before. And I'm not going to ask you if you think you fixed all the problems in the whole world, but I think you've taken a step towards helping these people. Thank you.
We now have the bill before us, and members, I've been reading through this Mr. Elringer piece here. I hope you'll do the same. It's very informative, and we're going to keep it with the committee here. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1801, as amended, be recommended passed the Senate Committee on Civil Law. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members, for your indulgence on this. We spent a lot of time on it. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.